Welcome back to Ladies with Gumption. This is episode number 43, Love Boat Part 4, Sink or Swim. I am entering this week. My name is Jessica, and I'm here with...
May.
And Tatiana.
And we recap DCTV in a flash. It is the very tail end of Happy Pride Month. And so while it is still Pride Month, I'm going to give two LGBT-friendly show recommendations because it's my intro and I can. The first one is Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which has a lot of acclaim, so a lot of you probably already know about it or heard about it. It's on Netflix, and, you know, the premise is pretty straightforward. Five gay guys go and make over a straight person, and they usually have some kind of bonding moment along the way. But what I think, and I didn't watch the original Queer Eye series, but what I really like about these guys is that there's a lot of, like, social issues and emotional issues. It's more, it's just as much about the actual guys and their backgrounds as it is about people that they're making over. So, like, the first season they had an incident where Karamo, who is black, was driving in Georgia, like, country, not Atlanta, but country Georgia. And part of the episode, the guy that was recommending his friend for a makeover is a cop, and so they had a thing where they pulled the guys over, and it was supposed to be a gag. Bobby was actually supposed to be driving, but Karamo insisted, and so it was a whole really, it turned into this really real moment because, you know, Karamo and even Jonathan and Tan were, like, super, super scared about what could happen, and they thought it was real. And then they didn't just show that for the shock value, but they actually circled back around to it with Karamo actually talking to one of the cops and about his fears as a black man and the police. And then in this season, season two just came out on June 15th, they have Bobby dealing with his rejection from the church and his issues with that. Everybody, the whole group, calls out Anthony for being white and straight passing. Because he made, like, a comment like, "I feel safe everywhere." He's like, "Because you're white." And then in the most recent episode that I saw, Tan was, like, confronting his ignorance about the transgender community because they had to make over a trans man who had just gotten his top surgery, and Tan had never met a trans person before. So it was really interesting because I just assumed that if you're part of the LGBT community, because it is such, like, a found family and you fight for your rights as kind of like a group, that, you know, one member knew about all the other letters and, like, their experiences, but it's, you know, he goes through the same kind of misconceptions as about the trans community as maybe a straight person would have, and that kind of uncomfortableness. So it's, you get, like, it's really comprehensive. And you find out a lot more about not just the makeover part, but actually, like, their life experiences. Have either of you seen Queer Eye, either season one or
really
this season?
I really want to.
I've never watched either the original or this version of it, but your description of it sounds much more, you know, interesting. Like, that's something that I would want to watch. Whereas, like, the idea of anyone making over anyone else is not something that interests me, which is why I didn't watch it before.
I mean, it's like, you know, that is the show. So of course there's that, but it also goes, like, a lot deeper than that, and they don't shy away from that kind of stuff, which I thought was really nice. And then the other series that I wanted to recommend that doesn't get enough acclaim, I think, as it should, is Pose on FX. And I think I mentioned when we were doing our Women of Color in Fandom series, like, I have, like, a My Diversity quotient now in TV shows that I want to watch. There has to be, like, a threshold of people of color for me to be interested in watching it. I think my threshold was, like, 3 people. And if there was a woman of color, that she counted for double. So, Pose has 5 transgender women played by transgender actresses. 3 of those women are leads, ensemble leads, and none of those women are white. So it's like set in New York in the 1980s. It's about, you know, ball culture for sure. It's also kind of about found family. It's in the 80s, so it deals with the AIDS epidemic at the time. The 3 leads. Blanca, well, I guess the premise of the show is that Blanca, she's originally part of the House of Abundance, and she's kind of like really dissatisfied. She doesn't really get along with her house mother, Electra Abundance, very much because she feels underappreciated. And so she recently finds out that she is HIV positive. And so she's kind of at a crisis moment in her life of like, what do I want to do? I want to leave a mark, a legacy for that will leave, live on after I die. And so she leaves the House of Abundance to start her own house, called the House of Evangelisa. And so there's this huge rivalry between her and her old house. She takes with her, one of her friends, Angel, who is, she's the second ensemble lead. She has kind of a side story with Evan Peters, because it's a Ryan Murphy series, so of course there's Evan Peters. And they have
always
they have kind of a relationship. So she's dealing with being the side mistress to this, you know, white man who's like straight. He's trying to make himself on Wall Street. He actually works for Donald Trump, which is it's the 80s, so yep.
Wasn't then, James Vanderbeek's role originally going to be Donald Trump?
Oh,
and
was
then
it?
They were, and then they scaled that back because they were like, let's not.
Yeah, let's not do that. He's still a douchebag, so it's Trump-esque. And then the other part of the series is Damon, who is this gay kid, wants to dance, loves ballet. He gets kicked out of his house for being gay. Like, his dad was really physically and verbally abusive to him, and he gets kicked out. He moves up to New York. Blanca finds him and pretty much adopts him into her new house. And so this is, the whole series is kind of about them building their own house and their own family. And it's just, of course, like, the visuals with the ball culture is amazing, but they also go through a lot of real issues. It's a really humanizing show. They go through even they deal with transphobia even from within their own community. I think episode where Blanca tries to have a drink at a gay bar, it's like a white gay bar, and she gets tossed out. There is, of course, dealing with AIDS awareness and prevention, stigmas about the trans community, all of that. So it's really just a really great show. Some of the actors are a little bit raw or green, but I think it's because like a lot of them, it's their first really major gig, but it's overall like it's a really great, great, interesting show.
Yeah, I'm a little bit behind, but I really enjoyed what I've seen so far. I think it's probably like, it's been a while since, and I guess it's partially because Ryan Murphy is not like creatively the driving force behind it. The writer is, I believe, a black gay man. And so it like, feels really authentic, and it is the first show in a while of Ryan Murphy's that I'm really, like, fully invested in.
Yeah, it definitely seems very authentic. So that is that. Watch those two shows, especially Pose, because I think it needs the recognition. It's not... I haven't seen as much of it as I think there should be out there for a show like this. So... contact information, if you want to get in touch with us, as always, you can hit us up on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us an email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com. You can send us an ask on our Tumblr now, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. We are on Podomatic, iTunes, and Google Play. We did have one email feedback from our friend Angela, and it was about our Evolution of Women in Sci-Fi series, and she is a huge Xena fan. Tati, did you want to break down her email for us?
Sure, I can try to do that. All right, well, she sent us a very nice, long, and juicy email in which she talked about how formative Xena was for her, especially because not only, you know, was it like a new standard for female representation, but also it brought more awareness to her as someone who was sheltered, which I think is really cool. She did, however, mention, you know, obviously she didn't notice the lack of racial diversity as a child, but in retrospect, they did cast a handful of Maori actors in minor roles. But given that they took some Pacific Islander influence in the soundtrack, it's worse that they appropriated that without incorporating those actors front and center in the show. Let's see if we have anything else. Oh, she did say that her friends and she all dressed up as Xena characters one year for Halloween. So it's definitely, like, that's the kind of that's the kind of influence that it had on pop culture. And she also, I know that the only con she's ever gone to was a con to see Xena actors. So I think that's cool that, you know, like that's her version of, like, for us, you know, like DC, Marvel, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, which I like. And also, she did want to shout out Gina Torres playing Cleopatra on Hercules and Xena, which is something that we obviously did not remember at the time, or did not remember to say at the time. So, she also was in Cleopatra 25.
Yeah, I was trying to remember that for the life of me, because I wanted to mention it on the podcast, and I could not remember what the name of the show was. So thank you, Angela, for that, for reminding me.
Yes, thank you for bringing that one up. Which reminds me that we didn't talk about Battlestar Galactica on the show, which was a pretty big experience for me in sci-fi. And also it did have a, not necessarily leading, but an important woman of color in one of the main roles, a Grace Park playing Boomer. And she becomes, like, even though she's, like, a clone, right? I guess, spoilers. I'll just say, she's super important, okay? She's super important to the end game of the show. And she has a romance that's, like, the most fleshed-out romance on the show, etc. Okay? They treated her really well. That's great. They did not treat Candace McClure very well at all. That was terrible. But at least they treated Grace Park well. Okay. Moving on. What else did she say? I think that... That's pretty much all she said, other than she was bitter that Xena had two musical episodes before Buffy, and no one brings that up. Everyone talks about the Buffy musical episode changing the game, but Xena had two, okay? And now I have to watch those.
I remember her mentioning also that she assumed the music soundtrack for Xena was, like, Greek or something along those lines until she heard the Moana soundtrack and realized that it probably had much more Pacific Islander influence than she previously thought, which I thought was cool.
And she, like, she
said, that's a pretty interesting way to discover that.
And she wanted to go to Greece so much because of Xena, and she was, like, really disappointed when her parents told her that's not what Greece actually looks like. That's funny. So thank you, Angela, for your lovely email. Moving on, it's the final day for you to hashtag Judas for Candace, if that is what you so wish. We also still have the Girls Inc. campaign, which is steadily moving on. I think we're upwards of $6,000 so far. The goal is to get $10,000 by SCCC. So if you haven't already, please donate to a great cause or set up a fundraising page. There's a lot actually going on in the fandom right now to get, like, rewards, shirts, fan fiction, a lot of things that you can either win or have or donate, actually, to the campaign. So check that out. Teen Choice Awards. I think it's too late. We should have mentioned this last week, but we didn't know. It's too late to vote for them now, but Odette Annabelle is up for Choice TV Villain. Black Lightning was out for, I think, Choice Breakout Show. Mm-hmm. In addition to Anissa being for Choice Breakout Star, and then Katie McGrath was up for Choice Scene Stealer. So good luck to all of them. In the news, we have quite a bit, actually. Black Lightning is casting a few new Season 2 characters, one of which is a new love interest for Anissa, which, why? Because you haven't developed any of the ones you have for her already.
Thank you.
Anyway.
I'm so upset.
Also, a sociopathic scientist named Dr. Jace. I'm sure he'll be white. And a new school principal. Anybody else have other thoughts on these?
I was just going to agree with you on the love interest thoughts and say that, you know, we'll talk more about that in our in our breakdown of Black Lightning strips. But I don't know why they need a new principal. That one's a little weird.
Yeah. I feel like they already tried to send Jefferson to jail last episode.
And yeah, I don't know what would failed, make him want so. To
step down from being principal, because that's his whole thing. Like, he loves being the principal, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, could it be, like, I guess because he was accused, so maybe it's, like, controversy? Like, maybe there's, like, too much controversy, so they asked him to step down for a while or suspend him for a while? It's kind of spoilery.
Either that or the ASA now knows who he is and that he is Black Lightning, so maybe, like, the block is too hot for him to, like, be around a bunch of kids. And because they did have, like, a fire out at the school, so obviously Bias knows who he is, so I can see that.
Makes sense.
San Diego Comic-Con is coming up in this new month in July, and we have the panel schedules for all the DCTV shows. The CW shows will be having their own panels on Saturday, July 21st. If you want to know the schedule, get out your pen and paper. Black Lightning is at 11. Supergirl is at 3:30. Arrow is at 4:15. Legends will be at 5 p.m. And then The Flash will round it all out at 5:45 p.m. in Ballroom 20. Krypton will have their own panel at noon in the Indigo Ballroom. All the series regulars will be in attendance, which means for The Flash, Jessica Parker Kennedy will be there, so she will sit with her mom and dad out on stage.
Yay! Probably in between her mom and dad, but don't blame her for that.
Let's see. In other news, Young Justice Outsiders will also have a panel. Their panel will be at 10 a.m. on Friday, July the 20th, in Room 6DE. And DC Superhero Girls will be at 12:30 in that same room. There are, confusingly, no panels for Titans or Swamp Thing that have been announced yet. And that's a little bit weird. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's really weird because they're supposed to be launching in August and Titans just wrapped.
Yeah, like perfect time.
So it's like prime time for them to be debuting trailers, sneak peeks, first footage, maybe the first few minutes of the pilot. I don't know why they wouldn't want to promote that, especially since the service is like you have to pay for it. So if they want to encourage people to pay for it, I would think that they would have something at San Diego Comic-Con, but it's very odd, very, very odd.
Well, technically, I guess because Young Justice is going to be there, so that's something for them, right? Mm-hmm. But it is weird because you'd think that Titans would be like their big one. Like, that's like,
right. Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Is this DC Universe, do we know if they're going to have like a booth or like something to make up for maybe not having a panel or?
I'm sure they will. I'm sure the DC booth will have something for DC Universe, you know? Yeah. But they haven't really announced something specific. We just know that you can sign up to be a beta tester. So,
speaking of Titans, we do have a lot of Titans news this week as well. We got the full look of Robin, Brendan Thwaite's character, Dick Grayson, which is great. But like, we've seen like several versions of what Robin will look like. I'm kind of wondering why we haven't seen any of what anybody else looks like. That would be great as well. Any thoughts or likes, dislikes about Robin's look? Or lack of other?
He looks fine.
I think he looks good. But, yeah, I don't know why it just feels like muted. Like, I don't know why the DC just likes to mute things. like outside of DCTV, like DCTV is a little bit less strict on that, even though they're still a little bit like, cause the comic book colors is like so bright and colorful. Like the Robin suit, especially is super bright and colorful. So I don't know. It's kind of just like, oh, okay. It's like edgy Robin.
Yeah. I mean, it feels
cause it is the Robin suit. It's not Nightwing.
Right,
so
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they're trying to go for muted because they didn't get to do the Nightwing suit, but then why not just do the Nightwing suit if it takes place, like, years, and he's already split from Batman and everything, so...
If they're, like, the DC Universe, they shouldn't really have any, like, restrictions on what suit they can't use. Why not just make him Nightwing instead of an adult Robin?
Exactly.
And I think Twitter user at Cara underscore Quarel, so Q-U-E... R-L, which is Brainiac. They mentioned that Robin's looked a little bulky. Like, it doesn't really look functional for a Robin because, you know, he's got, like, a lot of acrobatic kind of moves and there needs to be a lot of movement in it, and the suit looks a little bit heavy, which I kind of agree with. But we'll see how it turns out.
It kind of reminds me more of, like, what they were trying to do for the suits for the DCEU. Rather than for the rest of DCTV, because I feel like the rest of DCTV is more muted, but there's more movement in the suits. Like, there's still leather and all that, but it's, like, I feel like it's much more lightweight.
Which suits are much more lightweight?
For the rest of DCTV, whereas, like, the Robin suit looks more like the DCEU outfit.
Yeah, it looks like that heavy-duty Batman suit, which is, like, too much.
Exactly.
We also got a breakdown on the pilot episode of Titans. It's from SplashReport.com. They give us some details on the Titans pilot. And what's interesting is that the title, the pilot episode will center mostly around Robin, Raven, and Starfire. Before they got into the individual character breakdowns for the episode, they suggest that this show is going to be very much not for kids. There are multiple F-bombs, swear words, so think of a more R-rated, you know, HBO, I guess, level series, and the tone is kind of dark with the violence and the gore. So we'll see, you know, I think it's going for that DCEU dark theme, so we'll see how that works out. For Robin, he's the first character that's introduced. It starts out with, like, a flashback that includes Robin and, I think, Raven. But for in the present day, he is someone that has kind of distanced himself from Bruce. He's actually said he's grown to hate Bruce and left Gotham for San Francisco. He's really afraid of becoming like Bruce, but he still wears the Robin suits or the Nightwing costume. So, again, why? He's taken up a career as a detective on the police force, and it seems like he's a little bit disconnected from the people that he's working with. So basically his years as Robin have done a number on him quite emotionally and mentally, it seems like. And he shut himself off from relationships and is very absorbed in his work. What do we think about this take on Dick Grayson's character?
I don't like it. Because Nightwing is one of my favorite DC characters, and I am not pleased that it seems to be so dark that they've kind of sucked out his sense of humor as well.
Yeah.
And that's like a big part of his character. And I know that there was a period of time where he and Bruce didn't really speak and whatever, but
yeah.
I hate just doesn't feel like a part of who he is as a person, you know? So I don't know where they're trying to go with this. Like you said, maybe they're trying to go for the DCEU feel, in which case I might not be a fan. but yeah, I from what that breakdown says to me, I don't know if I'm going to quite be in love with this version of Robin.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of it either. It sounds like they just basically want him to be Batman without being Batman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
Why do we need a Dick Grayson who has cut himself off from other relationships? Like, that's not, whatever. It's the opposite. It's the opposite. So I don't like it. I don't like Opposite Day. and I am intrigued. Oh, wait. We haven't talked about the others yet. JK. So that's all I'm going to say. I'm not a fan.
Yeah, I'm not a fan either. I guess I get why they're trying to go that route, but I hope that they swing him back towards more classic Dick Grayson. It takes like a shorter time to get there than as opposed to a longer time to get there. Mm-hmm. So basically, I hope they don't draw that out too long. The next person that they talk about is Raven and getting a look into her background. And it's her background is also a little dark. Her mother, Angela, is an insomniac trying to manage taking care of a problematic child like Raven. Her powers get some shine, spotlight. There's a deeply disturbed, almost demonic individual residing inside of her. So that should be interesting to see. Her neighbors are well aware of her strangeness. She gets bullied a lot in school, and it seems like her relationships at school are going to be a big part of her story moving forward. And in her story, we get introduced to the main antagonist, which is the Acolyte, who is a mysterious hitman whose intentions and superiors are unclear, but hint at a more extensive narrative at play. So, any thoughts on Raven's story or the Acolyte?
I've always found Raven's story really intriguing, and I feel like I'm looking forward to seeing it being done in live action, because I feel like it's definitely not one that we've seen. I'm glad that we're going to get to see her mother, because in the only comics I've read that are like really Raven story have always started her like, already away from her mother, away from, you know, the whole Trigon situation, and with, like, her aunt and stuff, you know, so it's, like, already her adjusting to, like, a life where people aren't supposed to know anything about where she comes from. So I think it's going to be interesting to see her already more involved in, like, that demonic situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a fan of any exploration of characters and their parents, so that is exciting to me, and I feel like she could be more in line with, you know, what we've seen of Raven in the past, like the animated series and stuff like that, versus, like, Robin. So that's exciting to me, so I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out, and I'm actually really happy that she's introduced in the very first episode.
Yeah, and I think the only thing, and I've seen other people bring this up too, is that, again, like, the fact that the actress that's playing the character is 14, and yet they're doing these, like, mature themes, like, the show in general is leaning towards more mature, and then you've got Raven, and it's like, well, why hire 14-year-old actress and then go this route, kind of, like...
I mean, it is, yeah. On the one hand, like, that is, like, I guess concerning, but it's like, as long as they're not, as long as the things that they're doing are, like, true to the character, and, like, that she is supposed to be that age,
yeah,
you know, then it's like, you know, as long as your parents signed the consent form, I guess, I guess it's fine. And I hope, you know, for me, it's like, I hope they're not doing any kind of, like, shipping, you know?
Yeah.
Like, let's not try and put her with Beast Boy, please. Let's not, you know, don't freaking ship her with Dick. That's disgusting. And don't do any kind of sexual abuse storyline within.
Yeah, there's a potential.
Yeah,
that's what I'm, like, worried about, you know? Because, like, other stuff, you can just, it's like CGI, it's like whatever, you know, like, it's fake. So, but with that kind of storyline, you're acting that out. You can't pretend, you can't not act that out, so.
Finally, the last part of the pilot seems to be focused on Starfire. So we don't get really Beast Boy interaction, which is weird because Ryan Potter was... Okay, let me back up. So Starfire's story in this pilot episode, she's introduced in a car crash. Like, her car's crashed, her driver is, like, thrown through the windshield, men are chasing her. And they also bring up her outfit that caused so much controversy online, and a lot of people just being stupid and showing their ass. In the pilot, she is introduced the night after a disco party. So, like many fans have said, we have said, the reason she looks like someone out of a 1970s club is because she was at one. So the dress and her hairstyle are not a part of her usual look. And the reason I brought up, like, Ryan Potter is because this breakdown doesn't really mention Beast Boy, but he was on, like, the scene at the same time when she was wearing the outfit. So I don't know. Maybe it's a flashback. I don't know. Or they went back in time travel. But for now, Starfire is, like, running on the run. She has multiple passports. She finds out she can speak multiple languages. Her identity is a little bit of a mystery. And she is, like, propelled on a mission in this episode that will sow seeds for the Titans and the rest of the season. So I'm really excited about her. This person seemed to be really excited about her as well. I thought that she was the most intriguing character in the episode. What do you guys think about Starfire's story?
It certainly sounds like intriguing person in this pilot. I'm super happy because I didn't think that they, from what we'd seen, since they hadn't released her poster or anything like that, I didn't think that she was going to be so big, like, have a big role in the pilot. But it seems like they're taking maybe three characters at a time. Or those are, like, the three main ones right now, and then everyone else kind of just filters in. So I'm really excited that she plays a major role and that everything that's happening with her sounds really fascinating. And she's, like, a pilot character introducing the same episode as Robin, so that's all I'm saying.
Okay. The hope is still there.
The hope is alive.
Yeah. That's funny. But yeah, I mean, I'm very much excited. I'm glad that we got confirmation that that's not her look at all or meant to be reflective of her look. Like, duh. And I think that it'll be interesting to see her, like, on a mission already, you know, and already involved in making an escape. And not just sort of, I don't know, I guess expecting, like, oh, we're going to learn in this episode that we have something going on. The end. You know? So it's already, like, we've already got the action happening.
Yeah.
So that is it. That is, it's been a very long intro, but a very in-depth, knowledgeable intro. So we're going to, well, actually, it's not over yet.
Oh, God.
Grant had a Seattle Con last weekend, and the season 4 blooper reel of The Flash was released a couple days ago, or yesterday, rather. Any short thoughts or impressions on either in this con or the blooper reel?
We've been fed so well.
We have, yes. In terms of his con, it was just really nice to see him interact with Kevin because he just seemed very comfortable and relaxed, and a huge turnout, and he seems hopeful, excited, like, I don't know how you would describe that, for season 5, and there was, like, a lot of questions about, a couple questions, at least, about Nora and how that will play into the season. Not that much was revealed about, like, the show news-wise, but it was still a decent panel, and no one was, like, rude, so yay. In terms of, like, the blooper reel, it is the best blooper reel that has been released ever for all 4 seasons. There's so much content. It's also the longest. It's actually funny. Like, I laughed quite a few times, and it's just adorable and cute, and it was so nice to see all the cast interacting in this way. There's just a lot of good content.
I agree 100%. Like, I'm so glad that we got to see the cast having so much fun together. And that Candace got to be more involved than they've ever let her be before. And for Grant's con, I think it's just really fun to see, you know, or it's nice that he's supportive. He's so supportive of West Allen, and that he really does seem to be looking forward to the Nora storyline. I will say that he had at that time said he had not read the script for season 5, for 501 yet. But Hartley, I spoke to Hartley at Saturn Awards on Wednesday, and by that time he had read the script for 501. So everyone's read the script now, I guess. Yay for that. And it's nice that we got to see Grant and Candace's very natural, you know, interactions in the blooper reel as well, because I know that a lot of people have a lot of questions about the way that they interact, and now you can just watch these 9 minutes and see that it is very normal, and anything abnormal errs on the side of things that you would like and not things that you wouldn't.
Yeah. And I agree that this is, like, the best blooper reel that they've done 4 seasons, even not just, like, content wise, but the way that they set it up with Marley's and Clifford.
Yeah, so funny.
They used, like, the footage from 403, and it was just, like, the way that they set it up was really great, and it flowed really well. And you guys said, there's so much more of Candace in general, and just kind of funny moments that incorporated everybody in the cast. And then with Grant, I agree with y'all again. Just that, for one, it was just nice that he was at a con, period, because I think it was only, like, his second one. And that he did seem very excited for the season, that he was ready to go back, that he was supportive of West Island. And I like that, you know, with Kevin Smith, it was nice to have a moderator and not be worried about what the moderator was going to say or where the moderator was going to go, and kind of, like, veer off into anti-Irish territory. So it was nice to actually have him and have that be who Grant was talking off of. And it's really interesting that, like, a lot of, you know, Grant mentioning that a lot of the heart of the episode usually comes up organically in things with him and Candace that are elevated off the script. Like, the script is one thing, and then they perform it, and you see that it is something else completely when you play it back. And so that's kind of cool, in just, like, how they film the show. But enough of that. The format for this week kind of flows into what we were talking about, but it's the Love Boat. So all aboard, we will evaluate the Alpha and Beta submarine ships for each show, talk about how they fared throughout the season, whether they sunk or swim, and what that means for the narrative structure of the show moving forward. We have the Golden Child, which is Flash, Problem Child, Wild Child, Middle Child, the New Kid on the Block, which is Black Lightning, and the, I'm calling it the Indecisive Cousin, because I don't really know how to describe Krypton. So the host for this week is Tatiana. Tati, take it away.
All right. If you are the New Kid on the Block this time around, then we will let you know what an anchorship is to us, which is obviously the main ship of the show. But in order to be a true anchorship, you've got to be structurally sound, and there has to be strong emotional investment from both the writers and the audience. And so we will be grading on these components, as well as any others that we think of. So why do we call it an anchorship? Because an anchor is literally a piece of metal that keeps the ship rooted in the water, right? And stops it from drifting. And that is what an anchor ship needs to be able to do. It's got to be something, a ship, a narrative device that the show can always go back to and keep touching on to keep the story from running away with itself. Because it doesn't matter what genre you are or who your intended audience is, almost any fandom is going to be able to divide up the stages of a show by its core relationships, whether those relationships are romantic or if they are platonic. Because I know people talk about the Angel years on Buffy and the Riley years that everyone hates and the Spike years, you know? Or alternately, on Supernatural, what were Sam and Dean or what were Castiel doing at that time? That's where you are in your 13 seasons of Supernatural. So, our first, with that being said, anchor ships are not always permanent, as evidenced by the fact that you can call it a different era with the name of the ship. So sometimes the same vessel is going to need a new or different anchor because the current one is not sustainable, or because you get into different kinds of waters. You're in a different place. You need a new anchor. And sometimes shows just dump their anchor ship without warning. Or those anchor ships were not heavy or not strong enough to keep the narrative from drifting. So let's check and see how our DCTV anchor ships have fared after a season of pretty rough waters for a lot of them. First up is our Golden Child, the Flash. As you guys know, that ship is West Allen. They got married this year. They have a grown baby this year. So,
they moved so really fast.
What do we think? Did they sink or swim in season 4? And how are they doing on all the anchor ship criteria?
Well, the SS West Allen was alive and sailing strong throughout season 4. This is like a battleship that was unsinkable. Narratively, they were very strong. They defeated every obstacle that was headed their way, from Iris's unresolved feelings about how Barry left, miscommunication when he got back, the West Allen wedding, bad luck, you know, and getting their wedding hijacked when they actually did get married. The Kraken, known as Ralph, like all of these in their way, and they still came out on top. Writer support is still very strong. The Flash writers really stepped up this season by making Iris the team leader of Team Flash in Barry's absence, and having her keep that title once Barry returned. Because like season 1, Team Flash writers would have taken that title away like immediately once Barry got back. But season 4, Team Flash writers kept her as a leader and a strong, steady presence in the team, even after Barry got back. She's elevated as being on the same level as Barry, and they reinforce that with the We Are the Flash, and that's the theme that kind of drove the entire season. And even they even got their own married like nemesis together with the West Allens versus the DeVos. Iris and Marlies had their own, like, what would you do for the man that you love rivalry as well. That was really well developed. Even though it was still tangentially about their men, it was also about them as women. Their gold standard, West Allen's gold standard, was validated not only by several characters on the show, and most notably by Barry multiple times, but also by the writers. They are the ship that was chosen to anchor the crossover, even though it was later sabotaged by our Problem Child ship, which we'll get into later. But the fact that the DeVos started on the same level as West Allen in the beginning elevated the DeVos to be worthy opponents for Barry and Iris. And similarly, the dissolution of Clifford and Marlies' trust and their marriage was meant to contradict Barry and Iris' growing stronger, and kind of just reinforces West Allen being in that position of, you know, this is a relationship that's kind of untouchable or unmatched. That's why that they're the gold standard. And then, you know, just like comparing to any other show, OTP, Supergirl trolled their fans and sunk their own ship. Felicity ended with half the couple not communicating and the other half getting sent to jail.
Well, spoilers.
No, the same half.
Spoilers. The same half was not communicating, and then he went to jail. Legends broke up one couple, so one half can go back to 1942, and the other couple has intimacy issues because one's an assassin, the other one just found out she's a copy. And, like, you know, all like comparing all of that, like, West Allen has a rock solid marriage and a daughter from the future. Like, I'm not saying anything, but, like, one of these things is not like all the others. And that is, like, West Allen in a nutshell.
When you summarize it like that, you're like, ooh, man. I mean, yes.
They really got, some of them got screwed. Some of them got screwed.
Yeah. That's very true. I mean, besides being, like, the anchor ship of The Flash, like you said, West Allen is basically the gold standard of ships across all of DCTV, in my objective and completely subjective opinion. And I'll tell you why, because all other ships want to be them, and the fans want for their ships what Barry and Iris have. And it's why they probably have such active hatred for them a lot of the time from others. And at their wedding, every other character basically confirmed it. Like, their love inspires everybody, and other anchor ships like Elicity and Caramel have tried to rise to that level. Elicity during the wedding crossover and Caramel during the musical. Both happened during big moments for West Allen as a couple with their engagement and then their wedding. So if that doesn't tell you anything, I don't know what else to say to convince you. But Barry and Iris just survived a lot this year, and I think the writers still enjoy writing the hell out of them, because even though some might be disappointed we didn't get a romantic scene every episode, the writers still gave them big, epic, sweeping moments like the courtroom scene, the fantastic save in the season 4 premiere, and then there was a lightning rod scene in Flash Time, which is probably like one of the best scenes for them. And then they got a crossover wedding, they survived Barry going to jail, miscommunication, DeVos, Nazis, rude friends, and then they got a whole ass daughter, which means they're being centered even more going into season 5.
Plus, yes!
They literally got to run in each other's shoes when Iris got Barry's powers for a couple of days. And not only that, but like Jess said, promoting Iris to team leader and then having them have like a constant give and take in their marriage just shows that the writers truly see them as equals now more than ever before. They communicate their feelings to each other and they listen. The show has also allowed Iris to have just as much of a voice in decision making as Barry, and she's leaned on him for support this season like he's always leaned on her, and that's why they are the Flash. And that line didn't just go away after the first time it was said, but brought up several times to drive the point home for those who clearly didn't understand what it meant. They are partners, they are best friends, they are lovers.
LOL.
True superhero couple, power couple, if I've ever seen one. So, like, the gold standard shone throughout season 4 and is alive and thriving.
So beautiful.
Yes, we are. Are we wrong? Not really.
Exactly. Like, there's no other way to slice it. There's a reason why after, like you guys said, after West Allen get anything, other couples complain about their ships suddenly, or complain about West Allen getting things. Because we have it almost all. I know there's some things we don't have. Speaking of which, when you compare West Allen to the rest of DCT, especially the Arrowverse, then, like I said, there's no denying that they are the golden child. The showrunner's commitment to Sparkle Motion has not wavered yet. Major storylines in season 4 and upcoming storylines for season 5 were constructed specifically with West Allen in mind, or revolve around them as a couple in some way. And like a good anchor ship should, when the show struggles narratively, like it did with the Big Bad this season, it is West Allen that managed to keep them on track. Like, the first half of the season had the build-up to West Allen's wedding. And in that crossover, which was like a huge crossover and a huge success for DCTV and the Arrowverse, even if some people didn't like parts of it, the biggest talking point in that huge successful crossover, aside from West Allen's wedding being interrupted, was the mystery girl, right? And that mystery girl, whose identity kept audiences invested during the lulls in the back half of the season, and there were a lot of lulls. So the reason why the mystery girl was such a powerful presence with only such few episodes is because of the writer's investment in West Allen. You know, they're able to construct the most exciting thing about their season around West Allen, because that's what they are most invested in. And as the girl's already pointed out, the parallels from DeVos and the West Allens helped hit high points in the storyline that the Thinker otherwise wouldn't have. The best parts of the Thinker came from his dynamic with Marlies. And the dynamic of Marlies was inspired by Wes Allen. So there you go. It all goes back to their investment in that first storyline. And May pointed out they still get big sweeping romantic moments at crucial points in story. Like when the story moves most, even if it's a filler episode, the episode that we most remember, like Flash Time, tie back to big West Allen moments because one inspires the other. And we see how the writers rely on Grant and Candace's chemistry to carry the emotional weight of the show. And when they don't have it, which I will talk about in a second, the show also feels like it lacks something. So in that vein, our beloved anchor ship did have to weather a few storms when you're comparing them to themselves, right? If we're looking at West Allen in season 4 versus West Allen in previous seasons, they were a little bit lacking. Like a little bit of the shine was missing because the writers got a shiny new toy to play with this season in the form of Ralph. You combine that, like a new important character with a lot of new writers. We only had 3 writers that were the same, you know? So it's understandable. It's not, you know, I'm using the word understandable. Not that I understand it, but yes, that new writers might gravitate to something, you know, that they can shape themselves, which is why it seems like everyone felt the need to take a crack at who Ralph is. Yeah. But anyway, shaping Ralph for a season did take their attention away from their leading man, Barry, which affects West Allen, which affects the entities that West Allen supports, like the Flash family. And that's why we got fewer romantic moments from day to day and fewer family scenes from day to day, because we're focused on the Ralph-approved brand of humor and the hijinks that hopefully will be less prevalent next season. And in fact, when I interviewed Hartley, he did throw some shade himself. He was like, yeah, the writers were focused on other things. You know, they were trying to get some other things out of the way last season. But I think that Ralph will be more like his comic book self next season.
Hallelujah.
So I feel like that's a good sign to me. Yeah, that's a good sign to me. But yeah, anyway, turning the DeVoe arc into more of a race to save him severely lowered the stakes in the second half of the season. If you compare that to, like, the stakes are to save Iris, you know, and then everything, even though season 3 was kind of messy, everything felt purposeful. Everything had urgency because that's, you know, there's a real investment there from both the audience and the writers. And this one, you didn't feel it as much. But the choices to bring back Iris's journalism, as well as the cliffhanger for Dawn / Nora. I wrote Dawn, even though I knew I was thinking to myself,
you're
right,
still
Nora,
holding on.
Nora,
you're and still I still wrote Dawn.
Exactly. That suggests that they're back on track, like May said. West Allen will be, you know, the biggest anchor for the season next season. And again, Barry losing his job in season 4 to Shadow Ralph's job was a really bad sign. That was no good. But at the end of the season, he gets his job back, and who helped get his job back? Iris. So yeah, we're back on track again. Yes, success. Anchor repaired, anchor back in the water. And in fact, giving Joe and Cecile an entire baby just to create suspense about the identity of West Allen's baby also reveals how much narrative power West Allen still holds in season 4 of The Flash after 4 seasons of holding all the narrative cards. So you go, West Allen. 4 for you. Literally 4 for you, West Allen.
Well played.
Thank you. Moving on, we now have our submarine ship to look at, and we dubbed it Cinco at the start of the season. So since then, obviously, some things have happened. They're not, you know, they're still kind of submarine in the sense that they have sunk a little bit. So, would you like to give your thoughts on that process? On that journey.
This whole sink and swim, because if the submarine sinks, it's still, you know, it's a submarine, it's supposed to be under the water. Anyway.
Is anyone floating?
Is it floating? It died, so it's like a belly in the water. Unfortunately, like, although Cinco was a magnificent ship, like the Titanic, it hit an iceberg and it sunk. There was enough room on the wooden door for both Cynthia and Cisco. Oh, sorry. There was not enough room for both Cynthia and Cisco, so we had to let her go back to Earthman team. His heart will go on, I'm sure. But I'm sad.
Will it, though? I'm just kidding.
Will it? This one actually kind of stings a little because it was set up so well as a beta shift to Wes Allen, especially in the beginning of the season, in episode, I think it was 2. The A and B plots were designed specifically to parallel the anchor ship with their submarine ship. The show even brought in that season a parent for Cynthia, Danny Trejo, playing her father, Josh / Reacher. And so they were kind of like setting him up to be Cinco's own version of Joe, if you will. So like that kind of structure, they basically like copy pasting Wes Allen's structure by giving the woman a father figure for the romantically the man to play off of. So there's everything there for it to be the supporting current to undercurrent to the Flash. But part of the demise, I think, is undoubtedly that actress availability since Jessica got picked up on a new show. I feel like the writers would have wanted to use her. I think the writer commitment was there, and they would have wanted to use her a lot more than she ended up being in the season. It's unfortunate because the other side effect was that Cisco not having any stories at all, because his entire story was Cynthia, pretty much. And so instead he got stuck with a lot of side plots. So he's either supporting Wells and his deranged plot to outthink the Thinker, or he was supporting Caitlin and her insecurities about not being as cool as Killer Frost. So it was a lot of like Cisco sidekick and not really a lot of Cisco. So the writers kind of just seem really lost with what to do with him outside of the ship. His story doesn't really pick up until the episode with Breacher and the job offer and then the subsequent breakup. And then like what lets you know how much the writers valued Cinco as the silver standard. You know, if Wes Allen's the gold standard, then Cinco would have been the silver standard, was how they showed the final, like, dismantling of the DeVos marriage and paralleled that to Cinco. Since they obviously couldn't do it with Barry and Iris, they took, like, this couple that was on the same level as the golden standard and used their breakup and paralleled it with the Beta ship, which is the silver standard. And then the death of the two ships, one ended because of a selfish love that Clifford had for Marlies, and one ending because of a selfless love that Cisco has for Cynthia. So it kind of shows you how much respect that they still had for the ship, even though it was ending. I'm a little bit wary in the future about them bringing on Valerie next season as a love interest. I think this is going off of the spoilers, because we don't really have an official announcement saying that she's going to be cast as a new character. I'd rather them find Cisco an independent storyline, since he hasn't really had one since, like, season 2, when he first discovered his powers. So we shall see if Valerie does come on, how they'll do that with Cisco, and we'll get to see if they want to keep Cisco and someone as the subship for the show, or if they'll switch it to another pairing.
Mm-hmm. That would make me sad, but it is a possibility. But yeah, Cinco was legit the submarine ship, and I agree that introducing Cynthia's dad was an attempt to try and raise him to Wes Allen's level, or at least get the best parallels out of it. And with, I think it was 4-3, right? And the introduction of Breacher and Cisco having to do with him. 4-4, thank you. It reminded me of 3-4 with Barry trying to talk to Joe about kissing Iris in front of him. And then Cisco and Cynthia really had something special, and they were going really strong for a while, but we didn't see Cynthia after 4-4 until she came back in 4-21, unless we're counting her brief appearance in the E-19 cube in the Christmas episode, which I don't. I think they were a really good couple, and they brought out different sides to each other. It gave Cisco a steady relationship, which is something we've never seen before for him. Then, of course, they broke them up, unfortunately, but I agree that paralleling the breakup to the DeVos relationship kept them as a submarine ship throughout season 4, even though they didn't have as much of Jessica Camacho because of her availability. But it did open doors, or rather, having her be available more often could have opened more doors for Cisco's emotions to be explored as a character outside of his job at Star Labs. So without Cynthia, he definitely didn't develop as much and instead had to play support to the other characters. And even his job story wasn't really explored enough, and that was most likely because they were using it for the ship specifically instead of something he was really thinking about, because we knew he wasn't really going to leave anyway, but they didn't really do much with it. And as a Breacher, like, he could have he could have come over to E1 as often as he liked while also getting to be with Cynthia, so logically it would have made sense, but then we wouldn't have gotten to see any of that development on screen with the relationship. So my hope is growing dimmer, but it's still there, and I sincerely hope that we haven't seen the end of Cynthia, even though she and Cisco are over right now. So even though the ship has sunk for now, the way it ended wasn't because of anything terrible, just two people wanting different things and because of long distance. So the water hasn't completely flooded the Titanic for me yet. And all of this to say that they were a great submarine ship that paralleled the anchor ship really well while it lasted.
Aww.
I'm so sad. I'm so sad.
Yeah, I know. There's not really much to add on my part about Cinco, although I agree with everything that's been said. I do think that they were meant to be the submarine ship of the season, but Flash hasn't ever really had as much luck there as they have with their anchor ship, which, you know, everyone's got to have a weak spot, and most other Arrowverse shows have the weak spot in their anchor ship, so whatever, I guess it's better to have it in the submarine ship. And I think it was clearly poor planning. Like, if they knew that Jessica Camacho wasn't going to be that available, or even if they found out, you know, over the course of the season, they could have incorporated more opportunities of Cisco feeling that long distance, you know, or having storylines on his side of it. And the fact that they didn't suggests that there was, like, less than the ideal amount of investment on their part to make Cinco work. Because if they wanted to, they could still have made it work with those few opportunities. Like, we saw her send him the cube that one time, so it'd be cute if he was preparing a cube for her one episode, you know? And, like, Caitlin could have supported him in helping him come up with, you know, Cyranoing, right? Come up with things that he should say if he's having trouble with that. Because, you know, Cisco's not the best in using his words. So. And obviously, like, he could have gone to Earth 19, and the fact that it's illegal to do so, and doing so could result in death, is very high stakes, right? He has to go see Cynthia for whatever reason, and so he's risking life and limb to go see her, and then maybe along the way, he meets someone that could have helped with the Thinker for an episode. I don't know. Just throwing things out there. If you care about the ship, you can come up with things for the ship that you care about. Anyway, but that being said, they did close it out for now, hopefully just for now, in a respectful way, right? They tried to do their best with that breakup, and they paralleled it, like y'all said, to Marvo, and elevated the importance of Cinco in doing so. So it did really feel like, I mean, it definitely felt like Cisco's most serious relationship, and you really felt like he was in love with her, and like that could have gone somewhere long term. So it was even more heartbreaking that wasn't the way she wanted it to go, you know?
And do we also blame Ralph for kind of sidelining Cisco in a way, since he did sort of sideline?
I would say that because Cisco used to be the funny man of the show, and so Ralph, like I said, he came in and brought his own humor, right? They're catering to his kind of humor. So Cisco was relegated to being, like, the butt monkey to Harry's storyline, which is a different kind of, you know, jokes than he normally gets. So I do think that it affected, you know, his purpose in the show, which then affected, like, the storylines that they were interested in giving him. So I would agree with that. On the other side, we have Marlies and Clifford, which I do think ended up being the de facto submarine ship of the season, because they were paralleling Wes Allen throughout, and they helped drive that narrative. You know, there was, like, a push back and forth in that narrative. It was interesting how they flipped the expectations, right? Because the way we started off, we thought it was going to be like, oh, it's just the power couple, the answer to Wes Allen, and it'll just be a battle of super couples. But instead, we had, like, the subtlety of how Clifford, or it wasn't subtle at first, but, like, Clifford cuts Marlies down, right, and wants to work alone, whereas Barry knows to include Iris, bring her in, and make her feel as, you know, as needed, as, because he needs her as much as she needs him, and he needs her to do his job. And Clifford also needed Marlies, but he wanted to act like he didn't, so he failed. But then, in the finale, we did get a subtle piece with Clifford literally, like, erasing Marlies from his memories in his mindscape, whereas Barry, in order to fight better and fight the Thinker, actually fuels himself with thoughts of Iris to fight better, harder, faster, stronger, etc. So, it's a little bit of a subtle parallel, even to the very end. And so the season ends with Marlies saying goodbye to her family with Clifford, while Barry and Iris welcome another member of their family. Yay! I love it. Okay, we've got some other minor ships that we can talk about. We've got Josiah. We've got Quick West. We've got potential future Ralph and Sue ship. So are any of these potential competition or, you know, vying to take the spot for submarine ship?
Yeah, I mean, like, nothing's going to challenge the actual anchor ship, for sure. But I think a potential challenger to the submarine ship / silver standard position is going to be Ralph and Sue, as much as y'all probably don't like it and doesn't like it. Do not be surprised if it happens. I'm just letting y'all know right now. Like, again, if we're taking the Reddit spoilers as semi-true whatever, then that potentially means that they're going to introduce Sue, and that they're going to introduce Sue through Iris. So already they're attaching a new woman to Iris, as opposed to introducing Valerie through Iris rather than Valerie through Joe, whose ship isn't an anchor ship. So, you know, just in terms of new women coming in, the one that's being introduced as a friend through Iris, I think is, you know, potential submarine ship, or submarine ship potential, rather. Also, again, speculating off of spoilers, Sue is a vlogger, so she has a similar professional interest as Iris. Ralph is a PI, so he's in the same line of work as Barry as a CSI, and so there's, like, a lot of potential for, like, double date investigating and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, the potential for them to set it up as parallels is all over the place. Going back to other ships from this season, Josiah got hit with a curveball early in the season with Cecile getting pregnant, but despite Joe's freaking out, it's been pretty much smooth sailing for them. I don't really consider them to be a beta just because they're older than West Allen, who's the anchor. So, like, I feel like...
Ageism!
It is. I feel like if West Allen's at the top, I feel like West Allen would go to Joe Seale for advice. And if the West Allen's at the top in the anchor position, I don't really feel like the anchor should be going to the beta for, you know, advice. I don't know. I feel like, you know, they can be old gold. Josiah is like old gold to me.
Terrible.
But that doesn't mean that they were complete without their West Island comparisons this season, because I really love the finale for the storyline, because I feel like being confronted by DeVoe was the kind of the moment that Joe was all in. So he had his whole love of my life moment that kind of, you know, it was very Barry-esque. Not that he hadn't been in love with Cecile before, but I think all the fear and paranoia disappeared in that instant for him. And it was kind of like a true commitment to protecting his family. And it's the first time that he's elevated Cecile to the level of Iris in terms of people that where his heart is. So, I mean, like, not even Barry. Like, Barry is up there, but Barry is up there because of Iris. Like, it's Iris, and then Barry's, like, a little bit below Iris, and then Cecile, Barry's level, but then in the finale, Cecile jumped up to Iris' level, which is, like, premium level. It's, like, top. It's, like, for Joe, like, that, like, she became, you know, up there on that level, which really kind of cemented their love and validated their ship and how it will last. And then, of course, they have a whole ass baby, so, of course, that means that they're going to be together. Jesse and Wally, like, what is there really to say about them other than that they shouldn't really have been a ship in the first place? They're cute in the beginning, but there are just too many things that I didn't like. A lot of red flags, especially about her being a hero in her own right on her own world and giving that up to move Earth for Wally while Wally couldn't figure out if he wanted to label their relationship or not. The breakup was hella ugly and disrespectful, and her ghost appearance on Legends was also just, like, compounded the disrespect to Wally as a character. It's clear that the writers didn't really care about this relationship at all. They cared more about Jesse in relation to her dad, and they didn't care about Wally at all. So you take two characters that the writers don't really care about, and you get a ship that took on more water, more and more water, until it just finally just sank, basically.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to start with Joe and Cecile. I feel like they had a lot of potential to rise as a beta ship, but the fact that Joe was barely around this season, and then Cecile only appeared every once in a while at first, though arguably more than Joe in the final third of the season, didn't let that happen. So they floated happily along, but the fact that the writers included a pregnancy story for them and then did a couple of parallels to West Allen near the end of the season elevated them for sure. And all of it really rested on Joe's shoulders, because he was the one that was reluctant since getting with Cecile for change. Since, like, the third season, you know, he was reluctant to take off his ring. He was reluctant at first to tell her the secrets of the team and all that, and then he just let her in, and in this season he was kind of freaking out in a lot of instances. So especially about like moving out of the new house and or out of the West house and all that. But I think with the birth of Jenna Marie, which is still a random name, he realized how his...
How dare they?
He realized how real his new family life really is, and, you know, has come to terms with all of these changes in a big way. And like Jess said, he elevated Cecile. And also with them upping Danielle Nicolette to series regular goes to show that the writers like her a lot, too, and want to write for her. And maybe in season 5, their status will rise. We'll see. But I do agree with Jess that if Sue does indeed join the show, she and Ralph could potentially replace Cinco as a beta ship. I don't want that to happen, but they do have a lot in common with West Allen with regards to their jobs, but it's still Ralph and he's not Barry, but they could have West Allen give Ralph and Sue relationship advice and all, you know, some cute stuff probably. So one thing I will say that I dislike this because it's like replacing Cisco as an ex-romantic sub-lead, and I don't want that to happen for Cisco. So, we'll see. But I think Flash just has so many ships, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Clifford and Marlies. They really started off as a supervillain power couple, and then that broke down pretty quickly, and then it got abusive, and the romance went from what was perceived as gold standard, ride or die, parallels to West Allen, to the exact opposite, with all kinds of, like, abuse, and they completely lost their shine, and we questioned whether we were all just kind of distracted by the shine at first. So this ship definitely sank, and sank hard. And then Jesse and Wally, the disrespect. This ship really started to wane by the end of season 3, and by season 4, it was practically cringy. Like, the breakup was really disrespectful, like Jess said, and it was really humiliating for Wally specifically. And we didn't even get to see their final conversation on screen. He's just like, I went to Earth 2 and came back, and now I want to leave. And you're like, okay. And it was, when she showed up on Legends, it was just weird because she spoke about what was perceived as Wally's insecurities, even though when those specific things were never shown on The Flash. And I only ever liked the ship at the very beginning as well, but after a while, you could definitely see the writers didn't care, and they didn't care about Wally especially. So it was a real disaster.
Tragic.
I know.
So I'll be kind of the odd woman out in that I very much think that Joe and Cecile have the potential to be the submarine ship for next season. But I think I have a different perspective on what a submarine ship or a beta ship is/does. So that might be why. But I think that their experiences are designed to parallel West Allen's. Yeah. So next season when Cecile were surprised by a baby later in life. And they were ready to just ride things out until retirement, right? So they're like, I'm unprepared for this baby. And then West Allen are surprised with a grown daughter who is their age before the time when they're ready to have children. So I'm expecting that we'll see, like, West Allen babysitting. And from that, they'll, like, grow closer to or become more prepared for parenthood in real time. You know, just in time for Nora to depart and then a real baby to arrive. And I expect at the same time, Cecile help, obviously, like, be calmed by the help that Barry and Iris give them, but also advise them on how to deal with grown-ass kids who don't listen to you, because that is Joe's life. And presumably, it's also Cecile's life with Joni. So, and also, I think the fact that they had planned the Cecile romance back in season 2, and we knew that from the casting calls for Iris's mother, because she was going to be in the love triangle with them, and Danielle Nicolette confirmed that she was supposed to, the romance was supposed to start season 2, but she got that other show, and they called her back as soon as that show was canceled, unlike someone else they have not called back, even though her show was clearly canceled, also showcases their, you know, that they had an investment in telling a romance for Joe, as soon as they could. On the, that being said, yeah, aside from that one, I do agree that Sue and Ralph is going to offer some competition. And be the true test of how the writers see Ralph. Because the way they wrote him in season 4 does not in any way invite romance. It does not make romance believable. It's not, you know, even for them, it's not someone that you want to see as a romantic hero. And first impressions are everything to writers, you know? Like, you write, you can't wait to get to what you want to write. You know what I mean? So if you're not showing something at first, it's because you don't really care that much. which is why I don't believe in slow burns. But anyway, moving on. I'm just saying, like, there's a slow burn. Like, the slow burns exist when you see that tension every episode, and you're just like, why won't they just have sex yet? My God.
Yeah.
And then when you barely see anything, that's not a slow burn. That just means they don't care.
Yeah. Yeah,
that just means they're not interested. But anyway, moving on. If they mold him to make a romance fit, right, if they make him into more of a romantic leading man like Barry, then that means that they aren't as invested in him as a character, because the way they wrote him at first isn't the way they want him to stay, you know, like they don't want him to be that way. So it'll be like Mon-El in season 3, like, oh my God, he changed and he's perfect now, and there could totally be a romance, and it flopped because they just, you know, they don't have investment in who Mon-El was. They don't have investment in who Ralph is if they go that way. If they go the, you know, keep him the way that he is, so it's super obnoxious and, you know, like, cringy, but then they only dip their toe in the romance, like, kind of make it the way that Cisco's romance used to be, where it's like, oh, he's hitting on her, and it's, like, kind of awkward, and it's, like, kind of cute, but, like, not that cute, because you're like, this is awkward and weird, stop! And then it just dies. then, so, yay, we don't have to deal with it. It'll go away really soon. And then there's, of course, the third option, which is that they don't change him at all, because they love him as he is, and then they make Sue have to be someone who would accept that and go along with that and either be as ridiculous as him or just be like the put upon girlfriend that has to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And that would be horrible. And then I will catch y'all on the YouTube videos that compile all the West Allen and Nora scenes, because we won't be watching the show.
No, she won't. She has to review. She has to review it on this podcast.
I will be reviewing the YouTube clips. West Allen and Nora.
I think my biggest concern was, now that you mention it, would be like that she has to go with it, but that she also teaches him how to be a better man.
Oh, whatever. God.
Because then I mean,
that's
like,
the most likely. Yeah. That's the most likely route. But like I said, if she genuinely is teaching him how to be a better man, then they just don't like him that much. Yeah. Because...
But I do think that they had Barry already do that. So when Hartley said that, you know, they're going to go back to his comic roots, it would be like, because in the finale, he was much more muted. And I feel like that's how they're going to continue to write.
Yeah, they will teach him how to be a better man thing in season.
Yeah, actually.
They've already.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Were you done?
No, I was just saying. No, I was just going to agree with you. Like, I think that they've set him, you know, like the level that he was at the finale is probably the level that they're going to have him at now.
Yes.
But that already showed that he's very he is as elastic, as plastic to them as his, you know, superhero name.
Yeah.
My last thing that I was gonna say was just Jesse and Wally, like y'all said. It's just an example of what happens when you stick to characters that you don't really care about, that you just wanna give them something to do. You stick on the ship because that's something to do. Mm. And they didn't even have a romance season. They had literally one 10-second scene.
Yeah.
So bye.
Actually, I forgot to bring this up during the Grant panel, and I'm going to just drop it in here because this has to do with West Allen, but he did kind of hint at that. He was like, oh, you know, we'll probably see them have a kid, and he wasn't referring to Nora as an adult. He was referring to, like, the beginning of them having a kid. So that's coming down the line, I'm just saying.
Yeah, and I also like that he said that he prefers that the writers don't give West Allen drama for the sake of drama.
Yes.
Which we all... you know, appreciate. So thanks, Grant.
Yeah. You know, he's still offended by that breakup in the 315.
He really
he's
is.
Still like, that was,
he's like, really... that was the stupidest shit.
All right. Now we move on to our middle child, Supergirl. It's a little bit, you know, as middle children tend to be, like, wants more attention than she's getting, but doesn't quite know how to get it, right? So... what do we think about Caramel's journey, the would-be anchor ship this season?
Do I get to throw salt on it?
Salted Caramel is what May likes to call them. The writers sunk their own battleship. You know, like the game, like, you sunk my battleship. They sunk it themselves. And it just kind of proves that it wasn't as strong as they thought it was to begin with. So despite, like, all the negativity you received from fans, like, because it didn't have very much... it had some support, because two white people in a ship will have some support. But it also had a lot of, like, negativity. But it was clear in season 2 that Caramel was a ship that the writers wanted to go with. So it had a lot of strong writer support. Whether that was more of AJK's influence or obtuseness on the writer's part... Carmel was the one that they went through all the trouble of sinking Carlson to let Carmel sail. It's been in like rocky waters throughout its inception because of such little fan support between Supercore, which is the largest fandom ship, and the general audience dislike of Mon-El's sexism and elitism. The ship had a pretty rough time in season 2. And then in season 3, Kara spent the first half of the season moping over Mon-El to the point that she was questioning her own humanity, which I thought was quite honestly ridiculous. So even like narratively, it was a little bit weak or didn't make a lot of sense. It wasn't really solid. It had a lot of ups and downs. It didn't really make a lot of sense. She kind of wilted under all the Mon-El focus in season 2. And then even now, when he was finally absent in season 3, 80% of her storyline still revolved around getting over him. And then to top it all off, he comes back married to someone else. And not only married to someone else, but neglects to tell Kara that he's married. And he and his new wife invade all of like Kara's spaces and push her to be okay with something that Mon-El had 7 years to get over, but it felt like just yesterday to her. And so there's kind of this inverted love dynamic with the lead being put under the romantic interest, which did not really work for me. It's kind of like the ship was inverted, in my opinion. And then the remarkable thing is that post-hiatus, the writers went to great strides to kind of like retcon the situation and with Mon-El and fix all of the fan complaints. And we got the ship kind of like righted itself with Mon-El pining over Kara, and put Kara at the top and making her the desired one, and Mon-El debating on whether he was worthy or not. So I felt like structurally they tried to course correct. However, even though they went through all these links to write the ship, it was already kind of really battered and hollowed out, and you could tell that the writers had kind of lost interest in them. So it was already kind of narratively weak, and then it didn't have a lot of fan support, and now the writers have lost interest in the ship. So all the things that could have pointed to having given the ship a second life, like the trip to Argo, which was basically like a date because they went by themselves, Mon-El's confession, and, you know, Kara getting it out of her system about how he treated her and him accepting that, all that stuff kind of flopped. And they ended not even touching or giving like any indication that they were once in love. And this is another ship you can compare to even the Silver Standard on The Flash with Senko, and see if the writers cared more about their subship, Flash writers did, than Supergirl did about their anchor ship. So that kind of shows you where they are with how they view their relationships in their respective shows. And like, this is the third year in a row their car has been left adrift, and probably explains why she doesn't get to lead her own show anymore, because they can't really find something to anchor her.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And I think for a long time, since probably the inception of the show, her ships have been all over the place. Like, they set it up for her and James to sort of, I think that they were going for like endgame status with them, or that's how it seemed to be. And then in season 2, there was a definite setup for her and Mon-El to be Supergirl's own version of West Allen, because I rewatched the musical and that's the only part that didn't work. except, you know, because he was a complete asshole and douchebag, so any comparisons immediately flew out the window. And it was just largely from his perspective. Like, he was the pursuer, which pissed me off because this was her show. And while they tried to make them the it couple, there were too many problems with Mon-El's treatment of Kara to really root for them. But it was clear that the writers at least rooted for them. And I really hated that we spent half a season watching Kara pine over Mon-El in the first half of season 3. And that seemed to be most of her story, because the identity thing went way off course, but then also tied back to him to an extent. And the love triangle was weak and awkward and kind of went nowhere. And then Mon-El... So, like, the love triangle just went nowhere because the ship sank. So it made no sense that they would have done it anyway, because it literally didn't... For maybe, like, 2 episodes, it created some angst. But there was nothing... There was nothing there, you know? And then Mon-El started suddenly pining after Kara, which is fine, because then it was more about her to a degree. But they attempted to absolve him of everything. Like, when Imra told him he was an honorable man and, you know...
Yeah.
he's suddenly a good guy that has done no wrong. Then more pining. But this time around, Kara was the one who didn't seem all that interested in moving forward with him after she spent the first half of season 3 being all about him. So it just felt like whiplash. And then it also felt like a candle that had been burning bright for her and then began going out very slowly, but without much drama or as many feelings as I'd expected from her. Then the most emotion she showed toward him was her anger. And then she just kept saying he's the man she admires, 7 years of his growth and all, but it's not much to be inspired by because she never told him that she loved him after he came back. So looking back now in our conversations about it, I can see the moments that were kind of leading up to something happening. But now that the ship has officially sunk, I can't understand why the writers even bothered to give them any moments if they weren't going to go anywhere with it anyway. So, like, any potential buildup was completely thrown out the window during their final scene together, and their interactions spoke volumes. Kara was obviously not interested, nor was the door even left open because he didn't even tell her that he and Imra were officially over. So when it sunk, the ship sunk hard and died with a whimper.
Yeah.
This is how the world ends, not with a bang, but with a whimper. For me, I have to agree. Like, in the way that I see it, when Kara is the one who is desired or is the one who is pursued, that's what puts her in the love interest position in this show, because it makes her passive, a passive or reactionary person rather than the one who's making things happen, which was the starkest contrast between Carlson, who was a man that she pursued in season one, versus Caramel, which is a man pursuing her in season two. And that's why I actually thought, like, I didn't like it, because I don't like Caramel to begin with, so I didn't like her pining for Mon-El and, like, healing from that in the first half of the season, because I was like, this is too much. But at least she was active in that, right? Like, she was actually, like, the one whose emotions counted in that, because he wasn't even there. But something weird, like, I don't know, when he came back, it was weird. Obviously, in retrospect, they were already flopping by virtue of the fact that Chris wasn't there for six episodes. So, like, clearly, he wasn't a guarantee, he was not doing anything important enough to stop him from landing back on the show earlier in the season. And there's nothing about the story that prevented him from doing that. Like, there's no way to cut that other than they had already gone off the Caramel ship by the start of season two. By the start of season three. That being said, it was really obvious once he came back, because even though they had him waver on his marriage and start pining over Kara again, in my opinion, a little too late, because they were like four or five episodes where he seemed like he was actually happy with his wife and just, yeah, you know, felt bad for Kara. So they started that too late. But either way, it made him look weak-willed. It made him look wishy-washy. And clearly the writers didn't find it hot, because Caramel did not flourish from that, you know? Instead, it was just kind of like Kara was as wishy-washy on him as he was on his marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
And even in the first half of the season, like I was saying, at least she was in control of that narrative. But her pining for Mon-El was almost like a beta reaction to Alex and Maddie's breakup. Like, it underscored, yeah, you know, how they fell apart. And then it was Alex's grief that took kind of the center stage. And Kara was just kind of in the background being like, I feel that too. So for whatever reason, the show's heart had already moved on from Caramel. And I don't know, like, on the one hand, it could be the negative audience reaction, which, still, if you allow the audience's negative reaction to affect your story, it's, unless it's, like, an issue of, like, I mean, I guess you could say, like, maybe it is an issue of, like, social justice or whatever, like, because he was a slave owner and he is this and that, so maybe they really did see that, but they could have tried to course correct. Like, they did change his personality, they could have made that work, but with that changed personality, I guess they just weren't into it, for whatever reason, you know? Maybe they're just not into a love story between either, you know, I don't know. They wanted an actual story between equals, or they aren't into one, because once they made them equals, they got rid of it. I don't know. Anyway, then we have the subship, the submarine ship for Supergirl, which is another one that kind of changes by the season.
Yeah.
But I think this season we feel that it was Guardian Corps.
Yes. I think that now that when you brought up the whole thing about the contrast between season one and season two with Kara, with her, you know, actively pursuing James versus being actively pursued in season two, it kind of reminded me of the subship this season, which was James and Lena. Lena actively pursued James. So mm-hmm. Lena had, like, the Kara season one love storyline where she's like, and in both storylines, James was the
he's a passive lover.
Lena had she had the love gumption.
Yeah, she had the love gumption. So I don't know what that means as far as Kara not being seen as lead of her own show, but possibly Lena being seen or felt by the writers more as a lead than Kara. But anyway. the only thing anchor ship wise, or in this situation, submarine ship wise, that Guardian Corps has in common with Caramel is the extreme lack of fan support. Mainly, of course, Super Corps is the common thread in both of those, because one ship has one half of their OTP and this ship has the other half. So they don't like both of them. But I think that this ship has fared better than Caramel only because the writers actually seem to like the ship. So it has writer support, and it's also a more narratively strong, it's narratively stronger than Caramel. They like this ship mainly because they like writing for Lena, I think. The main reason that James was kind of refocused into Cat Co. wasn't so we could get more journalism, because that didn't happen. It was so he could be close. It was so he could be close to Lena. So, like, you see, once Lena and James actually start dating, I think you spend a lot less time at Cat Co. because, you know, the writers don't really care about Cat Co. They cared about Lena and Jaina, or hooking up James with Lena. The writers' initial back and forth over the ship was a little bit confusing, which I think goes into, like, the whole structure and narrative about it, with both Lena and James, like, flirting with each other, but also, like, not wanting to be tied down in a relationship with each other. I think part of that was because they were still trying to force Guardian Corps into this beta narrative, paralleling the kind of struggle between the Caramel anchor ship. So you see, like, in one episode, James was kind of, I think this, he had been ghosting Lena, and now he was trying to call Lena, but this, oh, it's okay. So he was, like, ghosting Lena while Mon-El was kind of, like, ignoring Kara and all, like, pretending to be all happy, lovey-dovey with his wife. And then once Mon-El finally decides that, oh, maybe I really am still in love with Kara, then all of a sudden James is like, wow, I should really call Lena back. And then they have this, like, conversation with both of them. Like, we need to get our shit together. And it's like, well, you know, this conversation is probably only happening because of the beta anchor ship, sub ship kind of parallel propping struggle kind of thing. So I don't know if that's the reason why it was a little bit wonky in the beginning, but in the back third, they really seem to let go of pitching Guardian Corps to Caramel, and then that's when they hit their stride. There's a lot of, like, there's a lot resting on the ship now that not only the anchor ship sank, but the previous sub ship, Sanders, also sank. It's currently sailing on the strength of Lena, pretty much. Guardian Corps seems more like a tugboat than a ship. It's going to, like, pull along the show and ground the other characters around it, whether fandom wants them to or not. You know, like, Effie, it may not be the most conveniently attractive ship to fandom, but it's solid and on its own merits, and it's going to man you to love it. Because it's not going anywhere. It's like, you're gonna love me.
Not going.
That's how I feel about it.
It's funny because during SDCC last year, after Makad said James was getting a romance, I thought they'd try to do it with Rain, but then Lena obviously made more sense within the narrative, so I was completely wrong. And a part of me sensed that they also gave Lena a romance, one, to replace Sanders, and two, because the writers seem to enjoy writing for her more than they do for Kara, like you said. And I'm not sure that the writers took Guardian Corps too seriously in the beginning, because that's how they wrote it, with James half in and half out at any given time. Yep. But then James and Lena did start becoming honest with each other, and that allowed their relationship to feel more mature, and then also progress their emotional growth as well as their personal narratives. So I think not giving them enough attention at first was a bad idea, probably not to outshine the anchor ship, but then James and Lena thrived after Caramel began to slip, and of course, beyond being the only beta ship the show has now, which actually they're the only ship, James and Lena are both very distinct characters, and pairing them together went a long way in centering Lena, and also recentering James in a better position in the show than he was in season 2. So they're definitely pretty well so far. They're doing pretty well so far, and they're just chugging along, and I have a feeling that they'll continue to do so for the foreseeable future, especially now that Mon-El is officially gone. So unless they give Kara a romance with Brainy, or who knows, somebody else, then Lena and James have become the ship of the show for now.
I do agree that Guardian Corps is a consequence of like James's elevated narrative dominance this season, which is benefiting from the writers loving Lena and wanting the best for Lena. So, and I will say, I don't know if this was because I don't, not to get into conspiracy theories or not, like, I don't know if they knew that Jeremy was planning on leaving by the end of the season, but they did have two options for Lena. There was Wynn and there was James, and they did choose James, so I don't know what that means, but I like it. I'm glad that they did that. And also, you see that they take James more seriously because they decided to put him in a relationship with Lena. Mm-hmm. Like, Guardian was kind of a joke last season, and this season, Guardian is serious business and is super cool, and everyone loves him. Because Lena can't love a loser. She has to love a big, strong man. So, also, he's written as more in command. He's written as, like, wiser than before, you know? He's really, like, doling out that advice. Like, even in season one, like, as great and beautiful and pure-hearted as James was, they did make him, like, indecisive about love. Like, he had two girls that were, you know, going back and forth, and it made him look bad to some people. And that's not something that they are doing now, you know? They're not going to have Lena vying against someone else for James's attention. So, and I also think that, you know, yeah, some viewers, like y'all said, are not feeling that love. But the writers have made their stance clear when they had James take Lena's side over Kara's side and then explained to Kara why that was correct. And Kara was like, yes, that makes sense. I guess there's something I can do about that. So I feel like, you know, just like Kara has to accept it, so must the audience. And they haven't really had, like, much narrative momentum since then, but they haven't needed to, because we've just gotten to see them sort of, like, be domestic and, like, be supportive. They're in that kind of, like, West Allen season 3A phase, if you will.
Yeah.
You know? Like, before the shit goes down. And given that Lena and Supergirl are going to be on opposite sides, like, even more next season, most likely, than they have been this season, it's going to put James in a really interesting position, narratively speaking. And lest it all be about James, I think it does benefit Lena, too, because, like, literally, as a character, this is the first time that she's had someone that's fully in her corner. And it lets her be more of herself and perhaps even go further in whatever direction they want her to go. Because up till now, they've always had her pull back to go back to, like, the default, like, good, nice girl, so that people will like her, you know, position. And now she's got someone who's basically saying they're going to like her whatever decision she makes. So now she can make decisions knowing that she's not going to be abandoned. So we'll maybe see more of who Lena really is when she's not trying to avoid alienation. As for whether or not the ship will last, I will say, like, up to now, writers have given in to fan pressure on every heterosexual ship on this show, right? People don't like it. Suddenly they get rid of it. But there is the fact that, like we said, the writers clearly love writing for Lena more than they did for Kara, which suggests more investment in her ship, which suggests more resistance to fan pressure. So I expect that Guardian Corps will stick around. All right, now on to the other ships that have left us. That's all that's left, because they don't have any ships on the show. Only ships that have left us. So let's go.
Let's visit the ship graveyard. Sanders sank this season, and it was another case of trolling by the writers seeing as how they knew before season two that Floriana wasn't coming back, they still went ahead and got them engaged anyway. And that meant structurally the ship was shaky in season three because it was sailing with an expiration date. Like, everybody knew this ship was going to sink. And so, you know, you couldn't really get invested in the story because you were just waiting for, like, the hammer to drop. In addition, now that Alex's coming out story arc was complete, you know, and that's in addition to Floriana leaving the series as well, the writers just seemed less invested in their relationship. So structurally, it's shaky. Writer investment is lessened just because they only really cared about Alex's narrative coming out story arc. I don't really see how much, I don't really feel like they cared that much after her story arc was complete. And then Floriana was leaving, so it's just like, why bother, kind of thing. So they didn't really get this kind of screen time. They needed to deconstruct the ship to give fans that kind of emotionally satisfying, although bittersweet end. And I think it's because they just weren't as invested in it anymore. It had and still continues to have strong fan support because fans didn't really get that satisfying breakup. They coupled with the facts that Alex was still saddled with, like, a one is the loneliest number pity party for, like, half a season. And I agree with you now. Like, I didn't realize it before, but I think you're right, Tati, that that was kind of when they were still pretty much the submarine ship, using that to parallel Kara not being over Monel, they kind of paralleled those two journeys together, and actually Alex was more of the primary than Kara's was. But still, like, only one is a lonely summer kind of thing was just not great. Mm-hmm. And it will be difficult, I think, because of the way that they ended the ship and how many fans are still such strong supporters of the ship. Like, you can see on Twitter now, people are still asking, like, when is Floriana coming back? Like, she's not coming back. But the fact that that kind of satisfying end, it's just going to make it more difficult to introduce someone new for Alex, which I think she needs someone new, not just like a hookup with Sarah on a crossover, but she needs a new love interest. And I think it's going to be difficult to introduce someone, have it have the same kind of fan support that Sandberg has or had. So I'm not really, I don't really know how they, because they're kind of a hot mess when it comes to their ships, man. John and Magan, ... several question marks. You know, the writers don't know them, so there's not really about that ship.
that makes me sad. Tears.
Yeah.
So with Sandverse is certainly interesting, because it's one of the only ships of the Arrowverse where I would actually say only Alex benefited from this for the most part. Like, in season 2, Maggie was brought in so that Alex could have her coming out story, and then their romance played well as a beta ship and was often much sweeter and better than the show's anchor ship during season 2. And back then, we could also ignore the fact that Floriana Lima wasn't actually Latina. And even while
I didn't ignore it.
Well,
I know, but it was easier to not notice in the narrative. Yes. Cuz we could just say, "Oh, she's generically non-white."
Yes. Yes. And even while I enjoyed them in season 2, they did rush to get them engaged, and then that threw off their entire journey for season 3. Then they tried to give Maggie a fuller backstory with her dad, and that obviously failed because neither of them were actually Mexican, and it was honestly too little too late given the fact that she was already on her way out the door. And I agree that there wasn't enough time to develop them, going from super happy couple to Alex wanting to be a mom in the span of like 3 episodes. So it felt like that whole plot was shortchanged, and it ended in a way that wasn't satisfactory for anyone who shipped them at all. Then Maggie was brought up a lot over the course of the season, and all it did was remind us that Sandverse had sunk and isn't coming back. So it just took a sharp turn toward more turbulent waters and really whacked that iceberg. But in hindsight, it feels like the writers turned the ship towards the end intentionally by not allowing proper time to give it a good send-off, knowing full well she was not returning. So that was like a fuck-up on their end. And then Magan and John is a ship I would have loved to see, but the writers hate us. And Wynn and Lyra, I'm pretty sure that the writers completely forgot Lyra even existed, although Jess says that they probably broke up off-screen.
I think they did. Like, I don't even remember her. And there's no, like, Wynn didn't even mention her once, so...
Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, she was a figment of everyone's imagination in season 2.
It's okay. I didn't like her anyway, so it's
fine. Yeah, I didn't either.
I'm not losing sleep over that one.
But it did exist, so it had to mention.
Did it? Just kidding.
Tati?
Is that the end of the story?
Yes, that is the end of my story.
That's the end of the story. Well, like you know, just pointed out, the treatment of Wynn and Lyra and that of John and Magan is definitely a symptom of romance not being Supergirl's strong suit, and in fact, being one of its weakest. Sandverse, I would say, coasted on the strength of Kyler's performance and the touching nature of Alex's coming out story, because that was something that obviously they were invested in and they wanted to tell. Like May just pointed out, it really benefited Alex as a character, and it didn't really do much for Maggie. Maggie was literally brought in to be the love interest, so outside of that, they didn't have a chance to develop her further, and they didn't really take that opportunity. And so once you take away the coming out story, because once you get to season 3, like, she's already comfortable in her sexuality, and she's ready to get married and stuff, you know, you're left with kind of a lukewarm story, then the writers weren't really committed to it. Like Jessica pointed out, they'd already kind of gone off it by the time they reached the breakup, so we didn't get a breakup that felt really satisfying to the audience. Like, it was still one of the, you know, better parts of that episode, the actual breakup, you know, and like the silent, like, goodbyes and whatever. Like, it was sweet, but it didn't feel like closure. And obviously the writers didn't feel like it was closure, because they gave Alex pining episodes, like, for like 9 episodes after that, unnecessarily so, given that they weren't planning on moving her on this season. I think that it would have been better to just, at this point, either, like, let Maggie go off to, like, some undercover assignment that she had to be gone for a while, and then Alex is like, oh, wait, you know, and then people can be happy about that for a while. Yeah. And then, like, a season goes by, and she can't wait no more. All right, great, you know? And then you've got someone waiting in the wings. But instead, to just have, like, sad, lonely, you know, Alex. And then, I don't know, like, next she's going to want, she wants to be a mom. So then we're going to have the added component of she'll have a child next season, hopefully. Otherwise, what was the point of getting her to want to adopt? Then have to, you know, deal with romance in addition to having a child, which seems...
I'm a little bit wary on whether they'll actually do that. And I wonder if her wanting to be a mother now and getting a child is going to be a substitute for not giving her romantic interest, which is no bueno for me. But
yeah, that would be no bueno. Exactly. I would not want that. And in that case, again, why not just not have Maggie have a problem with kids and give her a child while Maggie is away? Because then you still have two parents who are obviously very busy because we don't see Maggie, and you know, could die at any moment. There you go. You're still in the same position as you were before. Unless you're Diggle and Lila, who are like, oh, whatever, it's fine. I'm sure someone will take care of this child, even if we're constantly in danger of dying. Anyway, moving on. Don't want to, getting ahead of myself. As of right now, Supergirl has exactly one ship. And it is not anchoring the story, which is James and Lena. Like, it's you know, it's doing the best it can, because Lena is basically the lead at this point. But it's not the ship that is the whole story really revolves around. So we can make a guess that Caradox, which is what we have been told, is the actual shipping for Kara and Brainiac, could be their next attempt at having an anchor ship. But that's only basing it off of comic knowledge and all the fact that he's the only available character at the moment who could hook up with Kara. There has not been any real buildup for it yet.
Yeah.
Because romantic setup is just not Supergirl's forte.
That's like another, you know, we're talking about things that are a little bit kind of warning flags or makes me a little bit wary is the fact that they didn't set up anything for Kara and bringing it all in season three. Even like hint wise, there's maybe one or so, but even with the knowledge that they were going to destroy Caramel, there wasn't really any attempt to hint at or tease Caradox, even the finale of season three. So it's they're really going to be starting from like scratch, basically.
I feel like they just aren't really committed in having her in any long-term relationship at this point because they just do it so badly.
Yeah.
So but, like,
even then, like, even when you have a character who's, like, a serial dater or one that you're not committed to a long-term relationship to, like, you start them fast. It's like iZombie, right? Every episode, like, it's got a new dude. It's like, yeah, and they turn it on like that.
Right, and that would be fine if she was, but, like, they don't even do that. So it's like,
yeah.
Moving on to our problem child. Even though we made it sound like Supergirl gives us a fair share of problems. Of course, the anchorship on this show is Elicity. And it has a great deal of fan support, but do we feel that the narrative has supported it in its anchorship in this season?
Jess is already tired.
Yeah, okay, so, like, I feel like Elicity is, like, an old warship. It's seen better days. She'd probably be retired, but it stubbornly pushes ahead anyway. Yeah, it's like one of those old vet ships that talk about the good old days and how it used to go to school uphill both ways. Structurally, I think the ship is kind of hollowed out this season, specifically. Oliver and Felicity had their moments throughout the season, and it was mainly when they had William between them to anchor them together. But there's like an ice box where their heart used to be. They're so cold. The writers don't really seem invested in the ship anymore. They seemed more invested in earlier seasons. This season, they didn't really seem particularly invested in the ship, at least in which it relates to Felicity. They had all kinds of investment in Oliver and his new parent single daddy issues and all this kind of stuff, but not a lot when it came to Felicity. It still has strong fan support. It's one of the strongest fandoms in the DCTV fandom today. And that's the only thing that's basically keeping the ship afloat. But if it keeps taking on water like it is, not even the fans are going to be able to sustain it, I think, in the long term, unless, like, the writers do something to kind of, you know, reinvigorate the ship. We've made no secret about the lack of intimacy between Oliver and Felicity. We've talked about it several times on the podcast. Even after they went through all the trouble of just, like, hijacking an entire crossover for it to be about their love and get them together and get them married, nothing after that. And intimacy, when I say intimacy, it doesn't equal sexy times. Like, I know that's one of, like, like strong points that, oh, yeah, they have, we show them having sex and all that other stuff. But they didn't even have sex, really, sexy times this season. But that's not even what I'm talking about. I'm talking about lack of eye contact, touching, leaning in, specifically from Steven. It often feels sometimes like Oliver still saw Felicity as his tech support and not his wife. It didn't really help that he basically fired her, and then he went solo and disappeared for days at a time without so much bothering to check in with her and tell her he was okay. So there's, like, a lot of, like, communication issues. And then in the finale, after agreeing with her and her proving, you know, that she can handle herself and that she's part of this team, she's always been part of this team, and stop putting me in a corner, let's be partners, we're husband and wife, we need to talk things out. He agreed to all this, that they were a team, promised to treat her as a partner, and then he goes behind her back and makes the decision to turn himself in without consulting her, and then avoids telling her the entire episode. He goes to everybody but Felicity until the very last second. And then when they are together, right before he goes off, he doesn't really, there's just no kind of connection or contact. You see it 100% from Felicity's side, but this, like, brick wall over here, and there's no kind of, like, return. And I feel like the issues with his communication and his not trusting her and his, like, keeping her at arm's distance, all this kind of stuff, these are character flaws that should have been brought up and resolved before they got married. Like, the whole season, if they had really planned on doing this whole marriage after the crossover or whatever, they should have built up all of those issues and conflicts and should we or shouldn't we in the first half of the season, and they didn't do that. We shouldn't still be dealing with his, you know, past, because this is consistent Oliver character flaws throughout the series. But we shouldn't still be dealing with him after he and Felicity got married, because marriage is supposed to be, all right, you have accomplished this, here you are. It's supposed to make them stronger, but instead it feels like the writers just needed to kind of check a box on their to-do list of things to do before the series ends. It's like, oh, this is Felicity and Oliver finally get married. Check that box, now we're done. And then finally, Felicity herself was kind of badly underutilized the whole season. Being Oliver's wife should have elevated her to a position of importance to the writers, even more so than where she was. She should have gotten her and Curtis's company off the ground. Like, that should have happened. If the writers cared about Felicity and her importance to the narrative, she should have been the one to push back and go toe-to-toe with Oliver. She should have been the one that he had to argue with and finally be like, oh, you know what, you're right, kind of thing. But quite the opposite happened. Like, Dinah took over the leading lady status. She got an entire police precinct storyline. Dinah got a new Team Arrow. Dinah got a love interest and a revenge arc. No matter how well or not y'all thought it played out, which that's debatable how successful that was. But she got one. So, like, the writers, it clearly seems like the writers' interest, female character-wise, lies with Dinah. And I feel like they really need to reinvest in Felicity and remember what it is that made them fall in love with her. And maybe Oliver being away in jail is a perfect time for them to do that. But I feel like that's what really needs to happen to kind of recenter the ship.
Yeah. I mean, when they took a break from Felicity throughout all of season 5 and then started building them back up again near the very end and into very early season 6, it felt wise because they were taking it slow. Then the crossover happened and they rushed to get them married so they could parallel them to West Allen, but no matter how you slice it, it's not the same. And they hadn't really worked through some trust issues that they still had and other things prior to getting married, and Felicity's reluctance to move so quickly after they'd just gotten back together was completely warranted at the time. So after they got married, it felt like they took a big step backwards, and I agree, Felicity was pretty much sidelined to the point that if I didn't notice they were wearing wedding rings, I would have forgotten they were married. As a ship, they were standing still for most of season 6, and even though they were married, it did often feel like Felicity was just a placeholder for Oliver as a parent for William. So he'd have a backup parent if anything happened to him. And in their scenes alone together, his eyes were distant and his body language not at all like a guy who's happily married and in love with his wife. It really gave the fans scraps, I'm sure, because there wasn't much going on there. And then when your lead and the writers don't seem as invested in your ship anymore, then that's really a bad look. And Jess is right, Felicity as Oliver's wife should have elevated her, but the writers seemed way more into exploring Dinah as a character and giving her stories. So Felicity remained what she'd always been, tech support, and didn't even let her vocalize what seemed like her fear of taking care of William on her own until that final scene before Oliver is arrested. So Felicity was more like Oliver and William with a dash of Felicity on the side for the nuclear family effect. But besides that, he completely disrespected her by not sparing a moment to tell her about the deal he'd made with Samantha, and then making their quote-unquote goodbye about saving the city and taking care of William and not anything having to do with them. Like, he didn't apologize, he didn't say that everything was going to be okay, he didn't, you know, reiterate that he loved her. It was just like, oh, well, you know, I saved the city and now you can get to take care of William. So it was unfair to her, and it was really annoying. So going into season 6, they're definitely not in a good place.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the question. Yeah, that's the thing. Like, the question is, like, it seems like they're in a good place, quote-unquote, narratively speaking. Like, for the show, they're probably still going to, you know, be married and, you know, have drama, but, and continue to be the main ship of the show. But structurally, it's like, you know, when the whole room is on fire and you're sitting there like, it's fine. Now, like I mentioned before, it's definitely, like, Felicity is an anchor ship that's buoyed by its popularity in fandom, right? That's really what keeps it afloat. And that's, in many people's eyes, what brought it to the forefront in the first place, even though I would argue the writers were always going to plan to do that instead because they liked Emily when they brought her on so much. But that being said, the writers do seem to have lost their drive for Felicity after season 4. Given that, you know, like May just pointed out, the going slow in order to reunite them is a good sign in terms of growth and realism. The lack of Felicity in season 5 before they flipped that switch back on is not a good sign in terms of their narrative power. The writers weren't, you know, chomping at the bit to write more Felicity and find ways to put them in situations that were not romantic, but still put their dynamic at the forefront, you know? That's the kind of stuff that you do. That's the slow burn that I'm talking about. That's how you write a ship that you really want together, but for whatever reason, such as people thinking that season 4 was a trash fire, you're not allowed to have them together right now, but you still find ways around that, right? That's how you write the things that you want. And since they didn't do that with Felicity, I would assume they didn't want it all that bad in season 5. Then they did start to bring them together. But again, it was like a slow crawl to start of season 6 where, like, William is suddenly an excuse to take things slow. And it's like a manufactured excuse because William doesn't actually care. As we see, when he finds out, he's like, nope, I actually did not give a single crap. So at that point, they then raise the stakes in the crossover, and then suddenly they jump to marriage. So you miss some of the, you know, some of the, like, going back into a relationship bits. Like, we just got, like, it was like they had, like, a little checklist, right? They're like, okay, they have to move back in together. Cool. Now they need to be married. Cool. Yeah, exactly. So, and it felt so manufactured that their marriage had no bearing on the plot of the show once they were married. Right. I'm pretty sure, like, even in the trial, like, they didn't actually use the can't be testified as your husband, right? Like, they just, I think they mentioned it. I think it was mentioned, but there was no, it wasn't even relevant for that, which we were suggesting that it might be, that might be a reason for it. Mm-hmm. Because it was unplanned, you think it's going to come up later. You think it's going to be a plot. But it wasn't a plot. It was just like, okay, well, we're married now and we're not going to talk about it. Until like 10 episodes from now when people have mentioned enough times that we didn't even talk about it. So I guess we'll talk about it. Anyway, both Felicity and Felicity were in stasis all season. The only growth that she got really was a byproduct of Oliver's growth as a father, because she got growth as William's stepmom. And the theme was kind of like fathers and children. I put father-son, but really Quentin and Laurel was more of a through line than almost anything else. So yes, it's fathers and their children was the theme of the season. And the fact that it took Roy's reappearance and the resurrection of Theroy, I don't even know how you would say that ship name, to give Felicity something to parallel to is not a good sign for that ship, because normally they'd be, again, chomping at the bit to find things to parallel Elicity with. Instead, it was like, Theroy shows up, you remember the earlier seasons of the show, and you're like, oh, that's right, I can do a parallel here. and it was a parallel that fell kind of short. Like, when he said it, it was like, that sounds kind of empty, because you haven't done that this season. But cool, I'm glad you said it, nonetheless. And like you guys pointed out, Dinah's rise to prominence was obvious, like, we can see that, but I don't know if it's a reflection of their inertia when it comes to Felicity and Elicity, or if it is a deep, abiding love for Dinah herself. Because I guess we'll find out, you know, in season 7. We'll see if the new writers and Beth, you know, go towards more towards Dinah, go more towards Laurel, right? Or actually give Felicity something to do outside of be William's stepmom. I should say, even centering Elicity more and making her more of Oliver's wife would be a positive change.
Going back to I think what you both were saying at one point, that how Supergirl relies on fan reactions to their ships and why they've given up on them so much, because they're not really invested. So if, like, oh, we don't like it, then we're not going to use it. And thinking about the backlash to season 4 of Arrow and how a lot of people did blame Elicity for it being so bad, which in hindsight is really stupid, but then they kind of laid off of the ship all throughout season 5. So they kind of did listen. Otherwise, they wouldn't have given two fucks and would have gone through with it anyway. So maybe they aren't as invested as we think they are, and they really do prefer Felicity on her own versus her being Oliver's, you know, significant other.
Yeah, I think they like the ship well enough, but because of the contentious nature of the show fandom versus the comic fandom and the whole Oliver, Laurel, Oliver, Felicity kind of thing, I think that they want their cake, they want to have their cake and eat it too, so they want Oliver and Felicity together, but they also want to appease, like, the comic fans that aren't huge Felicity fans. So what happens is that Felicity often gets shortchanged in the equation. Like, she's with Oliver, so you Felicity fans should be happy, but it's kind of like a hollow kind of thing, because they sacrifice Felicity for the sake of the wider fandom not liking or being into the ship, I think.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, not that they don't have investment in it. They obviously do. But, like, especially this season, it's just been... they've been slacking off.
Yeah. And that slacking off has been shown in their submarine ships as well.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, do they have one? They should have one. The reason why they need to revamp Elicity is because there is no solid backup, really, on the show. Dyla came into play to beta Elicity's alpha in a pinch once or twice this season. Like, I think there's that one episode where Dyla and Elicity had kind of like a double date mission kind of thing. But Lila isn't really around consistently enough for the ship to really support the narrative of the anchor ship. Cinco is also sparse in The Flash, but that was due to, again, Jessica's availability. Arrow doesn't really have that problem because, you know, I think that actress is available at any time. They just don't use her. Maybe now that Oliver is no longer the mayor, we can finally free up that set piece to give more space to Argus storylines. I think if I remember correctly, Diggle is still employed there as of the finale at Argus, so that would hopefully lead to more scenes with Lila, and to bring Dyla in as more of a constant undercurrent for Arrow. And then, like, Dyla and Elicity seem to really work well together, like in that episode where they were together and they played off each other. So perhaps if she's around more, then that will help level out the show. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Arrow is weird because they don't really have a major subship, but also because I think they
screwed everything up to begin with Laurel and Oliver, so it kind of fucked up the balance of everything else. So Dyla still exists, but Lila has only appeared twice in season 6, and once to tell Felicity that divorce is an option. But now that Diggle is working for Argus, like you said, we could see more from them in season 7, but they're very, very underutilized as a ship, especially this past season. Like, I wanted to see her more often, and she barely showed up. Unlike season 5, where they actually did have that back and forth, and they had a little bit of angst going on. Thea and Roy made a reappearance, and it was lovely while it lasted, but the fact that Roy is coming back as a regular in season 7 while Thea is off on her own adventure is really weird and messes with the ship's dynamic going into the next season. So they were also parallel to Elicity, but that was a bit weak because we hadn't really seen the anchor ship be much of an anchor this season. And then Dinah and Vince weren't developed very long before they killed him off, but it says a lot that they gave Dinah this romance to begin with and then a story for her afterwards. Still, I would have never considered them a beta ship at all, since that wasn't the point of their setup.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that Dyla, Theroy, and Dinah, each popped up for a few episodes to take their swing at submarine shipton, but almost all of them, you know, either they departed immediately or they just kind of didn't do anything. So Dinah and Vince actually left the most lasting impact on the narrative, because it led to the split in the team, which was the beginning, which was the main plot of half the season. But their story was told in just one episode because it was just there to service the beginning of the split, which is laughable. So that really does not count. And the previous submarine ship was the Roy in the early season. So I think that like leftover narrative power was really felt in Roy's two episodes, because the scenes that they got in those two episodes were, like, more romantic than almost anything else we've had all season. And like I said, it actually inspired Elicity to do some paralleling. But once they left, it was like they weren't there at all. So it didn't have any staying power. And that's so, which means Dyla wins the submarine ship contest by default, and that's not really a way to win. So hopefully Lila gets to be in the show more next season. moving on to the more minor ships. We've got a bunch of them. There's like Laurel and Diaz. There's Diggle and Dinah, if you're into that. There's Dinah and Vince, like I just mentioned. There's Curtis and Nick. Anyone that, you know, could be a contender? Could have been a contender.
There's no strong contenders. Laurel and Diaz was like nasty, just like gross. And it was also a little rapey, seeing as how she didn't really want to be with him anyway. And he was like overtly suggestive to her in front of her father, or her surrogate father. Diggle and Dinah was like the crack ship this season that nobody knew that they needed. It was like interesting, even though it was totally just off of like chemistry between the two actors and nothing to do with the actual narrative plot, but it was interesting. I feel like Curtis got a boyfriend because he needed someone to do while Renee was in the hospital.
Oh!
To Dinah's cop plot. So really, that was more about centering him, which is also, you know, another, like, Dinah versus Felicity. Curtis, towards the back half, was centered more towards Dinah's story than Felicity's story. And I think that leads to, again, the writers caring more about Dinah narratively than they did Felicity. So, you know, ultimately, we're scraping the bottom of a barrel when it comes to potential submarine ships in Arrow.
Yeah, I think Curtis and Nick, they've attempted to do, but Curtis will apparently get a new love interest next season, and so his romances don't really affect the larger story, but his scenes with Nick were at least cute, and then Laurel and Diaz is a big nope, and they have zero potential moving forward.
Curtis and Nick, like, I would say it had the potential, like, to be some kind of contender, to be something. Just because, you know, if we're going to take Dinah as the leading lady, then they're, like, paralleling her story. So in that sense, it made sense. But they kind of killed it. They kind of killed that potential Sting Hartley vibe with a cop and a vigilante going at it by having him just be immediately cool with it. You know, like, you'd take the air out of the balloon there. And now they're double killing it because the casting call auditions, spoiler alert, suggest that Daniel, the next, you know, the gay businessman who's coming in next season, is going to be Curtis's love interest. And that ex-husband Paul may come back into play. So, sorry, Nick. You're done now.
Poor Nick.
Yeah, you tried. Moving on to our wild child, Legends of Tomorrow. We had two potential anchorships, so let's discuss between Avalanche and Steel Vixen, who won?
Probably Avalanche, because Sarah's the lead, but they took their time to set it up, so it didn't really seem like that strong of an anchor. They didn't really get around to hitting at the ship until 9 episodes into the season, and, you know, the whole enemies had a little, to lovers had a little bit too much enemy in the beginning, and kind of lacked that hate-sex tension that was immediately apparent in the season premiere that kind of just went away until they decided, oh yeah, we should actually do this 9 episodes later. The first kiss was written in a way for it to be an object of the male glance as opposed to it being about the development of the ship. So they kind of like hastily cobbled together a concocted fight between them to get a kiss, and then they only kiss at a time so that Blackbeard could ogle them, which was like not cute. They don't really seem to care about the ship or Sarah until the back half of the season. And then they ended the season with them apart. So it's really hard to tell where the investment in the ship is on the writer's part. Narratively, it's kind of hollowed out. It's not, there's no really strong narrative current to it. The writers are a little bit wishy-washy on whether they want it or not. Ava's a regular character next season, so obviously there could be more story there, but the survival of the ship, I think, remains to be seen.
I mean, I'm conflicted because while I think Avalanche will be the anchor ship in season 4, I don't necessarily think they were in season 3. And like Jess said, they took way too long to get started. And even when they did, things haven't quite settled into full relationship territory for them, and they still need to work things out. However, it makes sense that the writers would go this route because they've made Sarah the captain, so she is the de facto lead of the show. But several of their moments didn't feel as organic as they should have been, and they were much better off after they'd slept together or when they went on that date. But then the fight, like you said, to get them to a better place didn't feel 100% right. And then I don't know if they're endgame material at this point, because Sarah has always been very open to exploring her relationships and not necessarily willing to settle down in any way quite yet. So she's very much a free spirit in that way. But Ava's relationship with Sarah certainly gave her an upgrade within the narrative and will continue to do so now that she's a regular on the show. But it's not clear whether the ship will really set sail yet, given where they left off at the end of the season.
I feel like they left it, like, it was, like, ambiguous. Like, it's, like, definitely, like, clear that they're still into each other and, like, maybe even that they're going to move forward, but it wasn't, like, a really set-in-stone kind of situation. So we'll see how they go.
It felt to be honest.
Sorry?
It felt like a reset to me, to be honest. Like, a reset to relationship to the start of the season.
Yeah, which is something that Legends seems to like to do, given how they treated Nate and Amaya, so... I think we're going to go ahead and say that Avalanche was the new anchor ship for the season. And even if we don't agree with, like, the treatment that they got in season 3, like, I thought, like, it makes sense to me how it was the anchor ship, because the start of the season was the battle of wills between the Legends and the Time Bureau, and that was reflected in the specific tension between Sarah and Ava and their different ways of doing things. So in that sense, it works as a narrative device, because we didn't have, like, a big bad to anchor things. Mm-hmm. So, like, back and forth between the Time Bureau and the Legends kind of was what anchored it at first, until we got Zari, and then I think that Zari's personal story really did take over as the, like, emotional core. For the best, I think. I thought that was a good one. But anyway, Ava choosing Sarah over the Time Bureau, despite having been created by Rip, you know, which we find out later, is also an interesting choice, because Rip is the last remnant of the season 1 hierarchy for the show. So as gross as it is to, like, talk about it in that way, the show gave Ava to Sarah, which establishes Sarah as the top dog now, right? And then the season ends with Rip dying. So despite that slow build, once they got together, like y'all already said, it was like, it felt more natural. Like, it was like they were very cute, but they also sped them towards another breakup really quickly and unnecessarily so. Like, it's one way to write a ship, and obviously it's a way that they like, because they did it for Nate and Amaya, like I just said. And there's definitely a lot of shows that have gone on that makeup breakup routine, but it's not a routine that the Arrowverse has used or that has worked for the Arrowverse. I think the only one that did that or even tried to do that was Laurel and Oliver, and it was a mess. It was a hot mess. So it's not something that you want to follow necessarily, I would think. But keeping Avon as a regular for next season does show that they are committed to that ship for at least one more season. Mm-hmm. Or at the very least, that they can envision a storyline for Ava that does not tie back directly to Sarah, which is a positive sign in itself for Ava Lance's chances, because if they see her as her own fully realized person, then they are more likely to want to write a ship for her. Now, how about the, you know, the submarine ship, or, you know, the sunken anchor ship, the one that lost the battle?
The one
named Namaya.
Yes. They were the sub ship of an anchorless season last season, so it kind of makes sense that they're still a sub this season. Even if the anchor, I feel like you make some good points, Tati, but like I still feel like Legends doesn't really seem to really want an anchor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, you know, weak all around for all of their ships, but particularly for Nate and Maya, I feel like they kind of stalled because Nate was unpredictable on whether he loved and cherished her or thought she was a basic bitch. And then Amaya couldn't really commit to whether she wanted to screw the future and stay with Nate or just jet back to 1942. And their predicament didn't really make much sense in the sense that neither of them once thought to contemplate that maybe Nate was the one that she was always meant to be with in 1942, and that he's Kwasa and Mari's grandfather. I think that kind of like storyline that could have been and never was is maybe a sign that the writers weren't, investment wasn't as strong as, you know, if it would have been if it maybe was the anchor ship. So it's kind of a reason why they weren't the anchor ship, because they didn't really care to explore that. And I feel like they had to go out of their way to make episodes about Nate and Amaya work, particularly with the Memphis episode and how they kind of had to really construct that and bend the laws of reality to have Nate and Amaya go on a date in 1950s Memphis. It's like, it's just not realistic, dot to get. And then, you know, they also underutilized Kwasa, which could have been another sign of them being an anchor ship if they had used Kwasa effectively, because it could have lent to that storyline more and anchored the season, because she was part of the Big Bad trio. And she was the only anchor to the Legends from the Big Bads, because she was directly related to Amaya, and they didn't really lean into that at all. So for a show founded in time travel, it just seems like a huge lapse on the writer's part, that whole storyline. And they seem fairly invested in the ship for two seasons, but not to the point that they paralleled it or even connected it to Avalanche, which is kind of, again, like, you know, betas should parallel their alphas in some kind of sense, and they didn't even do that. So I don't even know what that says about Avalanche as an anchor ship, that it didn't get any kind of parallel to Nate and Amaya. But, I mean, again, it's just because Legends isn't really a ship-driven show, and maybe that's the reason.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that if Nate and Amaya were the anchor ship of this show, then having Amaya's granddaughter show up would have paralleled West Down's, you know, future baby showing up because of the time displacement or whatever, but they didn't do that, so. And I still think Steel Vixen was meant to be more of an anchor, but this show doesn't really have one, like you said, so they just, in general, kind of dropped off. And the writers seemed to steer clear of them during the first half of the season, which is understandable since they broke them up and then set up the ship to sink down the line anyway. So either way, they lost any anchor ship status that they could have had when the show decided to give Amaya a conflict with regards to her returning to 1942 and starting her family with someone who was clearly not going to be Nate. And that was made clear and clear as the season went on. So they really got them back together so they could have a nice, bittersweet end to their relationship. So they even kind of downgraded Nate as less of a leading man. And not that he was last season, but he was more central in regards to like, his character.
Yeah, they left Nate a lot in S this season.
Yeah. So and he swung from...
Fingers crossed that Ralph follows that same pattern.
Yes.
As Nate and Mon-El.
And he also swung from being a jerk to being sweet, and that threw me off. Plus the fact that they never introduced the father of Amaya's children told me that they didn't want to explore them as an anchor ship anymore, if at all. And I believe that if they had given Amaya's future husband a face and had him interact with Nate and Amaya, it could have developed into more of a love triangle of sorts. So while Steel Vixen sank, they sank with more grace than other ships, at least.
Yes, they did sink with grace. they were perfectly positioned to take over as the anchor ship after last season. But obviously the show didn't want that, and that's why they opened the season with them broken up, rebooted, and revealed a weak sauce reason why in the flashbacks. Which reminds me, of how Veronica Mars treated Veronica and Logan in season 2, back when Rob Thomas was dead set against telling that story, because that was what the fans wanted and not what he originally had envisioned. That being said, because Nate and Amaya doesn't have a particularly wide contingent of fans, I don't think it's a case of spite. I think it's just inertia. It's just comfort. Legends doesn't really like doing a main ship, like Jessica said. So the writers had that one plot point for Nate and Amaya, and they just kept hammering it home all season long until they eventually just are going to give us a whole new Amaya. So we don't know if that's just the end of this ship or if they're going to give him a different version of Amaya to hook up with. And anything outside of like a 213 flash moment where seeing this Amaya just reminds him how much he loves his own Amaya would dilute the ship anyway and be pointless. Finally, I will say that even though it's not canon yet, I do think that Nora and Ray is a contender for the submarine ship. So, you know, her story's been molded by him. She's going to be a regular next season. And married couples playing lovebirds is pretty easy sell to easily amuse writers. And Legends writers are easily amused. So, speaking of those, which ones do you guys think have potential to join the Legends of Tomorrow fleet of ships next season?
Yeah, I agree with you that the only potential ship I see right now, now that Courtney Ford is going to be a regular in season 4, is Dark Adam with Nora and Ray. Like, it's a little weird because he was first met her when she was still a child, but I mean, it would be a natural progression from last season and him working with adult Nora and Damien, and really going out of the way, even against his own team, to protect Nora and kind of like, rebuild her relationship with her father. And now that Nate Maya is sunk and Avalanche is kind of adrift, there's an opening for something new, maybe. So that could be another reason. My preference is that Amari is actually becomes a real thing and not just something that's in my head. We know that Maisie is still a regular, so we're getting a new Amaya, and I'm just hoping that it's an alternative Amaya that's into ladies, and not in an entirely unrelated note. I would not mind seeing Helen Torian, so.
I would like that.
Well, I second Amaya and Zari as a ship. That's something I would really root for, and we've yet to really explore Zari in a romantic position with the first time we really saw it being in the finale with Jonah Hex, but that was cute, but borderline weird, too. Nora and Ray, definitely. They wouldn't miss that opportunity, and while we think it's a bit weird, I do believe Ray deserves some happiness romantically, since all of his ships have sunk really badly in the past, and he's always been the other guy who's going to get dumped for the one true love guy.
Aww. I will happily
marry the bride.
It's his time to shine. I will happily trade Nate Amaya for Amaya Zari. So that's all I got to say about that. Amaya Zari for the win. Let's make it happen. Now, the new kid on the block, Black Lightning, has a pretty set anchor ship, and it doesn't seem like it's going to waver anytime soon. So what do we think of Jefferlyn?
Yeah, I call this the grown and sexy ship. Like, Jefferlyn has chemistry off the charts and has got an old familiarity about them already. Structurally, they're pretty sound. They have two kids, they co-parent, and years of history between them as husband and wife. The ideological difference that separates them is also mostly defined, although it could use some clarity, like why Lynn didn't go back to Jefferson when he retired 9 years ago. The writers clearly support the ship, so that's there. And besides the occasional display of thirstiness from Thowdy, they've never really entertained anyone other than Lynn for Jefferson, so I can't really see them ever trying to do, like, a mid-game ship. I just don't see how that would work, really, unless something really bad happened between Lynn and Jefferson. And she's it for him.
Something already did, right? So they're just kind of not going to go
through it
again.
How do you break up someone after that?
Right.
You know. Fandom-wise, they have the general support of audience. I don't really see a lot of, like, contention because, one, they're an older couple and they're an established couple, so, you know, there's a lot, it's easy to ship. And then, two, there's no real competition. There's nothing for a fandom to, like, go back and forth about. Lynn is an individual, I think, suffers from the usual romantic lead annoyance bullshit that comes with fandom, but it's just not really extreme, in my opinion. And then Jefferson, it isn't without its questionable drama for the sake of drama, but the ship is pretty rock steady.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Jeffrey Lynn is probably one of the only anchor ships in the DC TV verse that isn't about the two falling in love for the first time. I mean, history and being married in the past make sure of that. And instead, they're all about finding their way back to each other, and for the most part, it's played out very nicely. They also have the advantage of being older and more mature than the other DC TV ships. Plus, they have fantastic chemistry and a playfulness about them that's super adorable and also really sexy. I think the end of the season one gave them a bit of rushed drama with the miscommunication about Jennifer's powers, but thankfully it did not go on for long before they settled back down, and I would still like to see some relationship growth in terms of like you said, their history being explored more in season two, especially since they seem to have staying power. So basically, Foudy never stood a chance, and Jeffrey Lynn has easily pulled ahead of almost all of the other DC TV ships.
Definitely agree. Black Lightning is quite literally a family show about the Pierce family, and therefore Jeffrey Lynn are always going to be around each other as the matriarch and patriarch of that family. So that gives the show endless opportunities for ships' narratives and narrative threads to overlap, and they've already made some great use of that. And we see that the writers love the chemistry between Christine and Cress, because they will turn the most mundane scene into an opportunity for sexy banter and, like, heated looks at bare minimum, right? And then sometimes they'll be like, let's just do a massage here. So, like, clearly they're really into the physicality between them, the emotional and the romantic tension. They got all that. And it's not a ship without its holes. Most of those come from the unseen backstory. It would be nice if we had a few flashbacks to young Jefferson and how they first happened, as well as getting clarity on why they spent such a long time estranged, because I think that's going to help them, you know, shoot to anchorship stardom, seeing as they're already number two on my list of DC TV ships. Speaking of, another one with potential to be a number two, but we have not yet fulfilled it, is our hopeful subship, Thunder Grace. So, discuss.
Yeah, Anissa and Grace started out fire, all chemistry and tension, but then that whole, like, BS breaking up of Anissa and Chenoa, if they weren't really ready to move forward with Thunder Grace, kind of, like, sputtered the little ship. Like, it was starting to, like, get off, and then it kind of, like, stutter-started a little bit. Anissa and someone seems to be the more stable subship material option than Jennifer. So if we're looking for one, it's probably going to come from Anissa. She got her power before her sister, and she closely worked with her father, and there's already a lot of parallels between Anissa and Jefferson in season one, so it makes sense that Anissa is going to be one half of whatever the submarine ship turns out to be, which is, it better be Thunder Grace. next to Jefferson, she's arguably the Pierce that the writers are most interested in, just seeing as how at least the first half of the season was very Anissa heavy. If Grace comes back into the picture in season two, I think that that's going to be the sub ship for the show, and hopefully it has less ups and downs than and not like a 9-year separation like her father. So
yeah.
Womp.
I don't think Thunder Grace was around long enough, unfortunately, for it to be a fully fledged submarine ship yet. The writers tried it before Grace disappeared and the ship completely tapered off. And I think it's good that they did focus on Anissa, but her love life after episode 3 or 4 was pretty much non-existent, and the full focus was on her being Thunder. So since she will be getting a new love interest in season 2, and hopefully if Grace comes back and they make it a love triangle, it could prove to be more of a beta ship for sure. But now it's currently TBD, but definitely them giving her any kind of love interest, like, I agree with Jess that she is the primary one set up for a submarine ship.
Yep. I definitely think, like, since they've already taken their time setting up Anissa as a hero and as a daughter, and they took those things very seriously, so those parts of her narrative life are nicely set. And even though we haven't really gotten to see her job or jobs, and I still don't understand how she can be doing all the things she's supposed to be doing, it's not like that has been a priority for them. So at this point, if you want to flesh out more of her life, it's either flesh out her jobs or flesh out her romance. And the way that Nafisa has been talking, it sounds like romance is really the direction that they're going to take. And she's been vocal about wanting more Grace. So I do think that all that unfulfilled potential, that neat cute and, you know, the promise of sexual tension that we got for those like two episodes will come to fruition more, even if we bring in that new potential love interest. And of course, like, they didn't give us a description, they just said new love interest, so I guess it could still mean Grace. Like that one time that it said Barry's new lady love in the comic description and it was just Iris, and I worried for several months for no reason. So it could just be Grace again, but even if it's someone new, like we saw with Chenoa, Anissa, and Grace, clearly they're not against using a love triangle to jump a ship. So they might have, you know, Anissa meet some girl, date for two episodes, and then Grace shows up again, and she's like, well, I'm dropping this one too. Yeah, exactly. Now we've got those other minor ships that we can talk about, or really, like, the one other minor ship. So, thoughts on their attempts at dominance?
Yeah, Jennifer and Khalil is the other kind of main ship, if you will, on the show. But it kind of, it sucks as a potential sub, just mainly because of the way the writers kind of torpedoed that ship once Khalil got paralyzed and blamed Jennifer. They kind of really just crashed that ship into a wall and watched it burn. And now he's, like, with Tobias, and, you know, he's on the opposite side, really. So there is still a lot of angst potential for this ship with Khalil and Jennifer being on opposite sides, and that could potentially become a driving force or undercurrent in the show, seeing as how Khalil's connected to the big bad. We saw a little bit of that from Jennifer's perspective in the finale when she was talking to, what's his face? Old guy.
Old guy. Are you talking about Gambi?
Gambi. We saw a little bit from the perspective when she was talking about when she and Gambi had that talk on the cabin porch or whatever. But I don't think the writers particularly care enough about this relationship to make it angst-worthy. They really have to make me believe that Khalil is somewhat still decent underneath all of the trash mountain that is his outer personality at this time. So that would take a lot of work, I think, for me to believe that the writers care enough about the ship for it to be a beta.
Jennifer and Khalil did have more development than Grace and Anissa, even though they did sink because Khalil turned out to be an asshole who was currently drunk on power and anger. But as of right now, I'm not sure how salvageable the ship is at all. It does seem like Khalil still cares for Jennifer, but he didn't have any problem going after her dad. So even if he ever makes a decision, like if he decides he does love Jennifer, but that ship has just sailed. So I don't think it's
I don't think he knows that it's her dad, though. So that's
yeah, so it's a little bit less. Yeah,
but I just don't want it to sail, okay.
Yeah, okay, you don't want to sail. I agree. I mean, I would argue that Jennifer and Khalil actually wound up being the closest thing to a submarine ship in the first season.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just because, like, that angst between them came back around at the end of the season. Like, in the middle, there was, you know, that big lull. But it was this, you know, it started with, like, you know, friends to lovers. And then, you know, in Jennifer's mind, Jefferson's work gets in the way, you know, hurts Khalil, right? Like, what Jefferson is doing affects Khalil. And then at the end, obviously that angst and whether or not they can, you know, he can still love Jennifer but be on the opposite side of her and, like, actively hurting, you know, the things that she likes creates angst. That could lead to submarine shipdom as long as he continues to be in love with her while they're on opposite sides. And if that love that he feels makes him waver in his choices, that's all the story needs to keep the ship floating, even with Jennifer not taking him back, because she better never take him back because he sucks. But I don't think that there'll ever be a canon ship again, if you will. Like, obviously it's part of canon because it happened, but I don't think they'll have, like, a positive outcome. I just think it is something that could be narratively sustainable for however long. Yeah. So finally, we have our indecisive cousin. I guess we all have one of these. For Krypton. You know, they've got an anchor ship, but they kind of want you to think it's a, you know, super even love triangle. So let's talk about that. Yeah. Oh, square. Yeah, they want you, let's not, no one even remembers the square part of it. But yes, they would love for you to think it's love square. And, you know, we'll see how much it is. So
they want you to think it's a love square, but they're only interested in, like, one or maybe two segments of that square and not at all the other ones. So the anchor ship, obviously, is Seg and Lyta. They were set up as a backbone of Krypton season one. The whole season really paired them together and showed how they were strong as a duo. It elevated Lyta as romantic lead with her position in the Sagittarii, her house, the house Zod, even over her rival Nyssa and Nyssa's ship and the House of Vex. So House Zod, even though within the structure of Krypton politics, House Vex is supposed to be at the top and Zod serves Vex, but narratively in the story, Zod is over Vex and Lyta is over Nyssa. They made General Zod Seg and Lyta's child, so that's connecting them as well. Seg's main motivation for saving Krypton in the first place was because he couldn't see a world without Lyta in it. So, like, his love for Lyta is a whole driving force behind his narrative. Their love story is tragic as it may or may not ultimately turn out to be, drives the story. It has strong writer support, I think, in the fact that the writers really care more about Lyta than probably any other character on the show, but Nyssa for sure. And I think maybe, yeah, I think they even care about Lyta more than Seg, to be honest. House of Zod was just so much of the writer's focus, just as much of the writer's focus as Seg and Lyta. She's treated as the leading lady and given a supporting narrative of the relationship with her mother and also clear ideals of her being a strong leader and protector. Contrast this with Nyssa's lack of story. Oftentimes, the writers largely forget her or just don't write her motivations clearly or independently of her father at all. Nyssa is written as an accessory, and Lyta is more of a fleshed-out individual. So even when the writers try to go Nyssa Seg, the writing is mostly kind of uninspired, and the only way to get the writers to care about that ship or make it attractive was to appeal Nyssa as the poor man's Lyta Zod. So a lot of Nyssa's switch in character traits in the back half of the season were like recreations of Lyta, basically, with her contention with her father, her now all of a sudden knowing karate, her, and, you know, strategically martial arts, and, you know, all of that was just copy-paste of, you know, prototype Lyta, I think. Audience support is kind of lukewarm, because I don't really think Krypton doesn't really have much a strong audience anyway, and I don't really think that ships are their main focus at the moment. So the only, like, the mystery of Kal-El's grandmother is the only thing that's kind of haunting, like, the future of the ship, because they trolled that pretty well. So there.
It's so irritating. No matter what Cameron or any of the writers tease off-screen, it's easy to see that Seg's heart, the writer's loyalties, and the story belongs to his and Lyta's relationship, and primarily Lyta herself. And like you said, Jess, whether or not the romance continues, season one centered Seg and Lyta in terms of Drew Zod and why Seg wants to fight to save Krypton. And it also played into how Cameron acted in his scenes with Lyta versus the complete disregard he largely had for Nyssa. And the writers did give the pair some drama, but it was more or less resolved right before he was sucked into the Phantom Zone. And Lyta is the one Seg cares for the most and his only line to what's going on. And either way, it's the anchor ship because it's the one driving the story, whereas Nyssa largely felt like a love triangle afterthought, and the writers scrambled to find a meaning for her presence besides flirting with Seg or being catty towards Lyta. So they gave her the clone story going into season two to kind of give her something to do outside of all that.
Yeah, plus her being a clone in and of itself is already kind of a downgrade, although, right, you know, it might work for Ava, but I don't know that'll work for Nyssa. So, I agree, though, that, like, Seg loves Lyta unquestionably, and the House of Zod drove the narrative throughout the season. You know, so, again, Lyta is the most important woman on the show, with or without Seg's, you know, romance, which already means that most likely she will get Seg's romance, because obviously she's the character that the female that they're most interested in. That being said, we know this because unless Lyta is already pregnant, her romance with Seg isn't over yet because Drew Zod hasn't been born yet. So we're going to get a little bit more of that. And they made some attempts to waver, like to make you think they're wavering at the release near the end of the season, but they were motivated by choices Lyta made. So again, that puts her at the forefront of Seg's mind and of the narrative, even if he's like kissing Nyssa for 2.5 seconds in a terrible scene that we don't want to think about. Speaking of, what do we think about their rival ships? The ones that, you know, I don't even know, they don't even count as sub ships because they're rival ships. Like, if they win, then Seg and Lyta can't win. So, thoughts on Seg, Nyssa, and Lyta, Dev?
The only one that has a good chance of being a good midship, mid-game ship, is Dev and Lyta. And again, this is rooted in how much the writers love Lyta. They could still pursue Cygnissa and probably will tease it. I assume that they will still try to go that route. But any quote-unquote success that ship experiences will just be because of whiteness, and not really, because narratively it's just super weak. So, you know, even as I've seen a lot of fans, quote-unquote, suddenly want Cygnissa once Kara and Mon-El bit the dust. Just coincidence? Probably not. They probably are real fans of Krypton, but I just don't believe in their belief in Cygnus's love. So even as desperate as Nyssa has become to carry Seg's baby when she only just met him and he's given her zero reason to fall in love with him, the investment from Seg himself is just non-existent and superficial at best. And it's not something that I would think that if she is supposed to be Kal-El's grandmother or Seg's ultimate in-game romance, that there would be something from him, more than just lukewarm apathy. you know, it's just not there. They're one episode meant to push, narratively, they're one episode meant to push their strength as a couple. Their, like, debut couple episode ended with both groups of soldiers that they were trying to lead dead. So it was, like, an abject failure. Comparing that to whenever Seg and Lyta paired up together, it's just, there's no comparison. Like, one succeeded and the other one failed, and Seg and Nyssa failed. So it's not really how you build up an OTP, in my opinion. And then, not to mention, Nyssa and her father were introduced as two-faced scheming villains in the beginning of the season, compared to the very honorable and pious Zods. So again, it's like, Nyssa doesn't really get a lot of pluses when it comes to her potential love interest, her love interest potential compared to Lyta. So I just don't really see that going anywhere. But I could be wrong, because, you know, stranger things.
Well, I second the Lyta Dev part of the love triangle being worthy enough to be considered. I do feel like Nyssa was brought in solely to give Seg someone else to potentially love besides Lyta, but since the writers favor House Zod the most, Lyta wins no matter what, and that's why she and Dev are stronger than Seg and Nyssa. Objectively and narratively, Seg and Nyssa don't make any sense, and it's largely contrived. Dev and Lyta have a history, and their story plays out far more organically because you can really tell that they actually care about each other. And on the other hand, it's hard not to imagine that Nyssa has or had other plans for wanting to be with Seg, like the baby, but there might be more that hasn't yet been revealed. Or she plays like she has intentions, but the writers don't seem to have much in the way of her story, so she's just kind of there, and then her reasons are murky, and they'll find something to give her, but they don't have, like, you know, a true journey for her to go on.
That is definitely true. Yeah, I mean, they tried to pursue Seg and Nyssa to make the triangle even, and obviously they were pimping it all off screen, but like Seg's heart, the story just was not in it. As both of you have pointed out, Lyta and Dev feels much more believable and has been given a lot more care. But considering that, you know, Dev himself is not given very much care at all, he's definitely in that nice guys finish last situation, which of course is BS. But that's how the show sort of treats it. Like, yes, Lyta respects that he loves her and she cares for him as a friend, as a partner, but clearly she's just not that into him. So there goes that.
He's just not that into you.
Exactly. In conclusion, all those ships wish that they were West Allen, but only Jefferlyn come close. The rest of you have some work to do.
Basically.
And that is what you missed on Glee. And if you want to hear more of us after this ginormous podcast, you can next week, probably. But in the meantime, please send us feedback on your thoughts. Flame us or fawn over our thoughts, either at ladieswgumption@gmail.com or on our Tumblr, which is also ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. You can also tweet us at DCTVGumption on Twitter. And obviously, please listen to the podcast on iTunes, on Google Play if you're Angela, or on our Tumblr. Thank you, and good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.